Good afternoon, everyone. The meeting of the Health and Human Services Finance Division will come to order. First, I would like to, we do have a quorum. Is there a first order of business is to move approval of the minutes for March 14th.
So moved.
Representative Cantrell moves approval of the minutes of March 14th, 2019. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. The motion prevails. The minutes are approved. Thank you very much. Now, we have the chair is going to move item 3 on the agenda. Members, this procedural motion returns a number of bills to Ways and Means with a recommendation that they be re-referred to capital investment. So these are capital investment bills that were sent to our committee. All we're doing is moving them back, and those are House File 409, House File 960, House File 1902, House File 2040, and House File 2085. So the chair is going to move that all of those bills be re-referred to Ways and Means with the recommendation to go to capital investment. Any discussion? Sorry, to be returned to Ways and Means. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The motion prevails. Thank you very much for that, members. So also members attached to your agenda are the, some referral memos. I will just, those are just there for your information, that bills that were referred to Early Childhood Finance and Policy Division and to the Long-Term Care Division from this division. So we will leave it at that. So, members, the main business today is to hear from the departments about and to learn about market stability options. We're talking about the insurance market. And so we're going to have presentations today from four of our commissioners, and we're very appreciative of their time and that they're here today to present to us on this very important topic, and one which is really one of the front and center topics of this legislative session. And before we start, I would like to just let members know that what I'd like to do is go through these four presentations, let the commissioners make their presentations. I would ask members to hold their questions until we get through the presentations. So I believe everybody should have some note paper in their packet. If you wouldn't mind just making note of your questions as we get through, until we get through to the end. And then because we are going to cover a lot of ground here, I'm also, and let me just back up for a moment and say, of course, if you don't understand an acronym, if you don't can't read something that's on a chart, you know, please let us know. Those kinds of questions, of course, we will entertain as they arise. But bigger questions, we'd like to get through the presentations, then there will be time for member questions. What I will do, though, this time that will be perhaps a little bit different is ask members to ask only one question instead of allowing one member to ask question after question, as I've often done, so that everybody gets a chance, and we will come back to you. It's not, I'm not saying you only get one in the hearing.
Are you looking at me when you're saying that?
Well, yeah, kind of, Representative Grunhagen. But I appreciate, though, that you are very gentlemanly and cooperative with the committee, and I always do appreciate that about you. I do want to give members, of course, a chance to ask questions and have them answered. But because this is a huge topic, it's also, frankly, a very complicated topic, and I want all the members to have an opportunity to ask questions and to have their questions answered. So we will just try to be a bit more sharing the time among all the members as best we can. So any questions about that procedure? All right. Thank you very much. So we will start by calling up Commissioner Jan Malcolm from the Department of Health, and welcome to the committee, Commissioner Malcolm.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members. Jan Malcolm, Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Health.
Thank you so much for this opportunity today. I'm just going to spend a very few moments trying to put this, the conversation, which is fundamentally about market stability in the individual insurance market, in a little bit of context, and turn it over to my colleagues for a more substantive discussion about the ideas that are on the table about how to bring that stability to the market. I'm just going to really quickly run through some data which I'm sure are not new to you. I hope they're not. We have historically had and continue to have as a state one of the lowest rates of uninsurance in the country. And over the last number of years, we have seen steady progress at decreasing the number of people in Minnesota without insurance coverage. What I would call to your attention here is that we lost some significant ground between 2015 and 2017, according to the latest Health Access Survey. And that was deeply concerning to us, a full 2-point jump in the number of people without insurance in our state during a time of robust economic activity. The Healthcare Access Survey also lets us know that what's driving these trends is differences not only in what employers are offering coverage, but it fundamentally is a question of affordability, that folks who are eligible for programs, be they private sector coverage through employers or public programs, are increasingly finding the cost difficult for them to afford. So we saw an increase in the number of Minnesotans without insurance for the first time in a number of years between 2015 and 2017. Our strength in the insurance market historically comes from not only a robust safety net in terms of publicly funded programs, but also a really strong employer-based insurance market. And you can see on the chart on the left there that just over half of our insurance market comes from employer-based coverage. Medicare is the fastest growing segment of the market as the population is aging. State public programs represent 17% of the market. And for today's purposes, just very important to note that the individual market is 3% of our insurance market.
And Commissioner, excuse me for interrupting. I just want to let you know that members don't have the packet in front of them. And members, Mr. McQuillan is working on getting that for us, so don't worry, we will get that. And I just want to let the commissioner know as she's talking so that she wonders why we're all kind of looking around. That's why. Please continue.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate knowing that. So, again, I think important for today's conversation to know we're talking about various policy options to stabilize coverage in the individual part of the market, which is about 155,000 people. On the right side of this slide, if you can see it, this shows one of the benefits of our robust coverage system in Minnesota has been that hospital uncompensated care costs as a percentage of operating expenses is significantly, for our hospitals here in Minnesota, significantly below their national peers. And you can see there that the green line on top is the national rate, the Minnesota rate in blue below. If you took this chart all the way back to the beginning of Minnesota Care, you would find Minnesota hospitals quite in parallel with the national average. So it's been our state investment in state public programs that has directly contributed to this financial and appropriate financial benefit for our hospital sector. This next chart, I think, is important. This is really describing the fact that the out-of-pocket costs faced by consumers is growing precipitously. I'll point out that these data that I'm showing you right here, this is not specific to the individual market, but the trend line, if we had individual market data, it probably would look even more dramatic than this. The green line shows you the amount of the cost of care being paid by enrollees on the top line compared to the rate of growth. So these are not absolute dollars. These are rate of growth lines compared to the rate of growth in the amount of costs being paid by the health plans. Now, if you were to array, so this is cost. Who's paying the growth rates in cost? If you were to array premium trends on this same chart, it would quite closely track that bottom line. So the rate of premium growth has been more in line with the health plan cost growth. So the point of this being consumers are not only facing premium cost growth, but a really important growth in their out-of-pocket spending as well. And the concern, of course, is that the cost of the system itself is beginning to be more and more burdensome for people. And we know, and we've talked in prior committee hearings about the lost opportunities that we see in our failure to manage costs by really focusing on preventing diseases to begin with rather than only treating diseases with expensive medical care after they've already arisen. This tells you a little bit more about the characteristics of those Minnesotans, not just numbers. These are our neighbors and family members, 155,000 people. What we know about the people in this market are that they are more likely to live in greater Minnesota. They're more likely to be older adults between the ages of 55 to 64. They're more likely to be self-employed. 2 in 5 of these enrollees report working for themselves. They're more likely to have household incomes below 400% of poverty, and they're more likely to self-report being in only fair or poor health. So 10% of those in the individual market say their health is only fair or poor, compared to 5% of those with employer coverage. So that's just a little snapshot of the characteristics of the people that you're going to hear from my colleagues about in detail. This final slide, and this again, I'll call your attention to the fact that these are data based on the commercial population, so data that we're able to delve quite deeply into from our all-payer claims database. What we know about people whose healthcare spending falls in the range that we're paying for with reinsurance in the individual market, so between $50,000 and $250,000, this is a story of chronic conditions. 87% of people in this cost range, again, for the commercial market, but we would expect much the same pattern to be seen in the individual market, had two or more chronic conditions. And so my perspective on this from both a health economics perspective but also a public health perspective is, again, the importance of being laser-focused on managing chronic conditions in this population. And it's from that perspective that that one of the reasons why the governor finds reinsurance to be a less than optimal way of dealing with this problem, because reinsurance isn't doing anything to manage the cost of chronic conditions in this rate band, and arguably could even be watering down the incentives for health plans and providers to be investing in the management of chronic conditions for the people in this cost band. Reinsurance is a really blunt instrument to try to bring down the cost of premiums in this small part of the market when we see the concentration of cost around chronic conditions. The other thing I would note, you don't see it on this slide, but we have known for a long, long time that spending in the healthcare market is highly concentrated. The general rule of thumb that we use is less than 5% of the population generates over 50% of the spending. Colleagues from Commerce have shared with us that that ratio is even more concentrated in the individual market, and they have some data to suggest that in 2018, year-to-date, that there was over $100 million spent in reinsurance on 2,600 individual people. So that's a very large amount of money going to pay for the chronic conditions for a very small number of folks. And our suggestion here is that we ought to keep our eye on policy options that can help us be focusing on the underlying drivers of cost of care.
Excuse me, Commissioner. Representative Grunhage, do you have a clarifying question?
Just a clarification, yeah. Oh, Commissioner, just on that 50 to 250,000, the health plans are still paying 20% of that, so they still have a financial incentive to manage those chronic conditions. The way I understood you, it sounded like reinsurance would have a disincentive to manage those, but they're still paying out 20%,
yeah,
correct?
Yeah, Representative Grunhagen, I don't think that's the kind of clarifying question we want right now. The kind I'm saying would be clarifying, if you would write that down, and we can get that at the end, But I think that what I was going for is, like, I can't read the caption or, you know, what's that number? So if you wouldn't mind holding off on that.
So mistakes aren't clarification.
Well, no, and, you know, no, actually. Well, if you think they made a mistake, let's bring it up at the end. Representative Munson, something similar?
I did have just a simple question.
Could you pull your mic, please?
Madam Chair, thank you. On a previous slide where it said 10% of the people in the private market were in fair or good health, if you're in fair or fair or poor?
Yes.
What else is there? What
excellent or good?
Oh, okay. I just want to make sure that there wasn't worse than poor or okay.
Thank you. Please,
Madam Chair, thank you, and thank you, Representative Munson, for that clarification. And that concludes my remarks. I'll only just respond to Representative Greenhagen that what I think I said was that it perhaps moderates the incentives or reduces the incentives for plans to focus on cost containment. You're correct; it doesn't remove them entirely.
Thank you,
Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you very much, Commissioner. So, Commissioner Kelly from the Department of Commerce. And members, for this one, we do have, I think, we have a packet. Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair and members, thank you for the invitation to be here. I'm Steve Kelly. I am the Commissioner for the Minnesota Department of Commerce. Thank you to Commissioner Malcolm for introducing our presentation, and I am privileged to be part of a team that also includes Commissioner Bowerly and Commissioner Lori in working on the package that the Governor and Lieutenant Governor have proposed. So today my presentation is going to contrast the policy options before the legislature in terms of continuing the status quo with respect to the state's reinsurance program compared to moving to the governor's proposed 20% premium subsidy program. And to set the stage for that, I'm going to first walk through a little bit of history about how we arrived at this point. Certainly some members on the committee were in the legislature and participated in the debate on developing the reinsurance program, but other members may be less familiar with that history. So from 2014 to 2016, Minnesota's individual market and individual markets in other states across the country experienced significant instability. State-based issues were exacerbated by federal market stability mechanisms, such as reinsurance, risk adjustment, and risk corridors that were commonly referred to as the three R's, expiring or having their funding cut by Congress. Average premiums increased significantly for Minnesotans who purchased their own health insurance, moving from $206 to $526 per month from 2014 to 2017. In addition, the number of actively marketed health plans in Minnesota were reduced, and platinum plans that offered higher actuarial value for consumers were no longer offered through the exchange. Rising monthly premium costs drove consumers to lower actuarial value level plans with higher cost-sharing responsibilities for the consumer. Bronze plans became the most popular in the market. Rising consumer costs contributed to enrollment drops. As you can see from the slide, the individual market shrank from a high point in 2015 to approximately 260,000 by 2016. So in June 2016, Blue Cross Blue Shield Minnesota announced that they were leaving the individual market, citing individual market financial losses from previous years, with one source of losses being lack of federal payment of risk corridor money. During the summer of 2016, the remaining carriers indicated their intent to leave the individual market as well, unless A, all other carriers remained in the market, B, actuarially justified rates were approved, and C, risk mitigation mechanisms were allowed. Commerce worked with the remaining health plans to ensure that there would be an individual market in Minnesota in 2017, but it was a market in crisis. In response, Governor Dayton proposed in October of 2016 a 25% premium subsidy program for plan year 2017. The proposal was designed to provide an immediate discount on monthly costs for Minnesotans who were ineligible for federal subsidy assistance. The governor at that time proposed calling a special legislative session so that the 25% discount program could be put in place when Minnesotans were shopping during open enrollment, but that did not occur. The program was not passed until January during the 2017 regular legislative session. The legislature appropriated $312 million from the state's budget reserve. The program was implemented uniquely by each eligible health insurer and was operated by MMB on behalf of the state. Due to the late timing of the implementation, Minnesotans who were helped by this program did not begin to see their discounts until April, May, or June, depending on which health plan in which they were participating. While the program worked for those who purchased insurance in 2017, the program was passed too late to soften the blow of rate increases that shoppers encountered at the beginning of open enrollment in the prior November. The result was individual market enrollment dropping by approximately 100,000 people. Ultimately, the program spent about $137 million and served nearly 118,000 Minnesotans for 2017. There is an Office of Legislative Auditors review of the program that was published last year, and members may want to read that for further details. In 2017, after the passage of the 25% discount program, the focus turned towards finding a stabilization mechanism for the 2018 plan year. Commerce advised the legislature on different reinsurance models. Once the legislature decided to pursue a reinsurance model based on the now expired federal program, Commerce provided actuarial support on how to maximize the payment parameters to reproduce the impact of the 25% discount from Governor Dayton's plan. A program with these parameters was expected to cost approximately $315 million. The legislature settled on a reinsurance program designed to achieve a 20% premium reduction and cost no more than $271 million each year. The payment parameters were set at a $50,000 attachment point, an 80% coinsurance rate, and a $250,000 reinsurance cap. And I want to pause to emphasize that point, that in working with the legislature, the Department of Commerce assisted in the design of the reinsurance program with the aim, the designed aim of reducing rates by about 20%. The legislature repurposed the state's former high-risk pool, the Minnesota Comprehensive Health Association, to administer the program with Commerce serving as the fiscal agent. In order to run the reinsurance program, Minnesota needed a 1332 waiver from the federal government. Two critical points for members to note about the law passed in 2017 and the state's waiver application. One, 1332 waivers are five-year programs, but Minnesota only appropriated 2 years' worth of funding. And second, Minnesota's waiver application sought approval to operate the reinsurance program and to hold the state's basic health plan, MinnesotaCare, funding formula harmless due to the lower premium rates that would result from the existence of the reinsurance program. Commerce, DHS, and legislative staff were in contact with federal staff during and after the legislative debate on the reinsurance program in order to craft both legislative and waiver application language to achieve those goals. Unfortunately, Minnesota received unwelcome news in September 2017 from the federal government. While the reinsurance was approved, the Center for Medicaid Services did not hold the BHP harmless, substantially reducing the state's federal funding. Governor Dayton agreed to the approval of the reinsurance program terms and conditions, but did not waive the state's rights to the BHP funding. So the reinsurance program then in plan year 2018, beginning in October 2017, the with reinsurance 2018 rates were approved. Rates with reinsurance were around 20% lower than carrier-submitted proposed rates without reinsurance. Minnesota received $130.7 million in federal funding for the program in 2018, which was expected, the total size of the program was expected to be $271 million in size. This funding was what the federal government estimated it would avoid paying in advance premium tax credits because reinsurance would lower premiums across the market. So the $130.7 million was, in essence, giving us in cash money that would otherwise have gone to Minnesotans through the advanced premium tax credit. While Minnesota's individual market was stabilized through the implementation of the reinsurance program, it came at an additional cost. Minnesota lost $90.5 million in basic health plan funding due to the presence of the reinsurance program. As members are aware, just last month we received the first analysis of how the program worked in 2018, and the program was estimated to be $138.9 million in total size, much smaller than the previously expected $271 million. Minnesota's state share of the reinsurance program in 2018 is expected to be $8.2 million, but total state costs will be nearly $100 million if we include the lost basic health plan funding. The payment parameters for plan year 2019 remained the same as they were in 2018. Rates were again approximately 20% lower than they otherwise would have been. But at the end of 2018, Minnesota received a surprise. The estimated federal funding for plan year 2019 was reduced to $84.8 million, a reduction of almost $100 million from previous estimates of the federal funding, and about $45 million less than we actually received for plan year 2018. Knowing what we now know about the size of the reinsurance program in 2018, this reduction makes some sense but highlights the difficulty the state faces in accurately projecting future state costs across the five-year lifespan of the 1332 waiver and the variation in federal funding across that time period. In our fiscal note on the Senate's reinsurance extension bill, Commerce staff estimated the reinsurance program to be approximately $153 million in size in 2019. Combined with an estimated loss of $77 million in basic health plan funding in 2019 due to the reinsurance program, state costs for reinsurance in 2019 are currently estimated to be $145 million. This graph shows the seesaw effect on federal funding received and lost by the state due to the existence of the reinsurance program. As you can see, if Minnesota had the 20% premium subsidy program in place for 2019, the state would have netted more federal funding than we have received with the reinsurance program. In summary, the reinsurance program did help preserve the individual market in Minnesota. The program also had the expected effect on rates in 2018 and 2019, helping to lower rates approximately 20% in each year from where they would have been absent the program. But these successes came with costs, costs that were amplified by events and actions that were not anticipated in 2017 when the legislature passed the program originally. We now know that the individual market looks differently than we thought it would in 2017. While the individual market has stabilized, it has done so at a lower enrollment, approximately 155,000 in 2018, than previously forecast. Premium rates also are lower than expected back in 2017, thanks in part to the overall health of the state's economy. Unexpected federal actions also negatively affected the state. The federal decision to not hold the state's BHP funding harmless was short-sighted and unnecessary. Moreover, congressional efforts to repeal the Affordable Care Act and to eliminate the individual mandate also contributed to continued market volatility here and across the country. Question before the legislature now is how to move forward. Minnesota's individual market clearly still needs a stability mechanism, but the unexpected yet significant costs to Minnesota's budget from the reinsurance program call into question whether we should continue the same program beyond 2019. In addition, there's a need for a comprehensive approach that not only subsidizes the individual market, but lowers costs for Minnesotans, addresses the rising costs of health care, and improves access to comprehensive, high-quality health care coverage. Governor Walz's plan provides such a comprehensive vision, beginning with a 20% subsidy program. The 20% subsidy is designed to replicate the 20% discount for Minnesota consumers who purchased their own insurance without the negative impacts for the state that resulted from the reinsurance program. By administering the subsidy program through MNsure, the state will be able to integrate the discount into the shopping experience for individual consumers and start building the tax credit functionality for 2021, which will provide greater assistance to consumers, especially those outside the metropolitan area. The 20% subsidy program avoids the loss of federal funds for the basic health plan, but doesn't cost the state any of the federal funding currently being provided for reinsurance. Please recall that the federal reinsurance payments are avoided APTC dollars. So if the reinsurance program doesn't exist, those advanced premium tax credit dollars will flow directly to Minnesotans rather than to the state, and just as they did before the reinsurance program was put in place. The individual market is still in need of stabilization. I'm not aware of a scenario where anyone is proposing that reinsurance end and not be replaced. A scenario that some people have tried to describe is not anything that I'm aware of anybody actually proposing. As has been observed in the individual market, a subsidy or reinsurance is necessary to not price out younger, healthier people while also covering pre-existing conditions. A premium subsidy is more likely to preserve basic health plan funding. We already had a state subsidy program in 2017 that did not affect the basic health plan funding. In addition, since no federal money would be involved in the premium subsidy program and is only state money going directly to consumers in order to give them a discount, the federal government is not involved in that decision. The proposed premium subsidy also works administratively in concert with 2021 and beyond proposals, which my colleagues will describe more fully. When comparing reinsurance and the 20% premium subsidy, it's important to remember that the governor's plan is designed to provide a 20% discount to eligible consumers because it's designed to provide the same level of discount provided by the reinsurance program. In essence, the two programs are two different hows to get to the same what, a 20% discount or reduction in what is actually paid by consumers. Where the programs differ significantly is how they are administered and how the state structures the 20% discount for consumers. There's been a lot of discussion about how rates may go up significantly if we don't continue the reinsurance program. So I think it's fair to say that rates would go up under a subsidy program. So if you look at this slide with prototype invoices, and we're using 2019 data for this rather than trying to project into next year. So we know the with and without reinsurance rates for the providers, for the plans for 2019. And so a consumer under the reinsurance plan invoice on the left would see a cost of $367. If we had a premium subsidy program represented by the invoice on the right, a Twin Cities consumer at 450% of federal poverty, age 45, would be looking at a silver premium of $459. So the rate is higher on the right-hand slide than on the left-hand slide. But if you go down to the amount that the consumer pays, that amount is the same. And I think that's where the members need to focus their attention is not what the top line rate is, but what the consumers are actually paying. So the next slide is shows a similar comparison, this time for a single consumer in Rochester at the 450% level with $56,000 in income without a federal premium tax credit. And again, in this case, the actual premium paid is higher than for the other example, but it's still the same between the two programs. And this is an illustration using a different part of the state, Duluth, same kind of individual, same federal poverty level, showing the difference in net premium paid for that individual. So, as illustrated by these slides, Minnesotans should see the same costs under both programs, even if they are receiving the federal premium tax credit, which is this slide that shows someone 350% of poverty who does receive the premium, the federal tax credit, they would also benefit from the subsidy program. So if the two programs provide the same level of discount for consumers, how should they be compared? We propose that it should be based on the effects and costs of both programs across the state budget. And when you do that, the 20% premium subsidy program comes out ahead. It eliminates the negative impact on the state's basic health plan. It does not lose the state or state taxpayers any federal funding currently coming to Minnesota for the reinsurance program, but rather returns those dollars to Minnesota consumers. Because the 20% premium subsidy program provides direct subsidies to eligible consumers and increases the amount of federal tax credit dollars that will go directly to federal tax credit eligible consumers, the program helps the entire individual market. It also provides the best return on investment for the taxpayers of Minnesota by maximizing the federal dollars we can receive. Remember, the choice is not just whether we continue the reinsurance program versus replacing it with the 20% premium subsidy program in isolation. The governor's plan continues to provide needed stability for the individual market, but that's only the first step. The value of the 20% premium subsidy program is increased in plan year 2021 when it is paired with a state tax credit for individuals purchasing through Minsure to limit their cost to 9.9% of their income. The state-based tax credit addresses high premiums for certain ages and rating areas, even in the presence of reinsurance or premium subsidy caused by the high cost of care for certain ages and rating areas. And then in 2023, OneCare will provide high-quality, high-value health coverage at competitive prices. OneCare allows advanced planning for a scenario for carriers deciding not to continue selling statewide. It's better to plan ahead than have happen what nearly happened in 2016, scrambling at the last minute to prevent counties being without coverage. My colleagues from the Department of Revenue and the Department of Human Services will give you more information about those two proposals in a minute, but my final two slides illustrates the choices. Doing nothing to subsidize the individual market hurts Minnesotans who purchase their own insurance. And so this illustration on the left represents no intervention in the market. The second cluster of bars shows the effect of extending reinsurance. Consistent with what I've said about the similarity in the effect on people between the reinsurance and the subsidy program, the third group of bars shows the similar effect on people from the 20% subsidy. And then if you go to the fourth group of bars on the right, you will see the effect of the combination of the 20% premium subsidy with the tax credit aimed to hold the cost of health care to 9.9% or below of a person's income. When coupled with the state-based tax credit in 2021, we have the chance to significantly lower the cost of health insurance for all Minnesotans. Thank you, Madam Chair, for the opportunity to present before you today, and I'm happy, and at the appropriate time, I'd be happy to take members' questions, and I'm going to turn this over to my colleague, Commissioner Bauer.
All right. Thank you very much, Commissioner. I know there was members know there's a ton of information in that. It went by very quickly. Please do write down your questions. There will be time for questions. I think we're moving through pretty expeditiously, so that's great because there will be more time for questions at the end. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Liebling, members of the committee. My name is Cynthia Bowerly, and I am the Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Revenue. As Commissioner Malcolm and Commissioner Kelly have explained so far, the governor's approach is to really try to make health care and health insurance affordable and achieve better health outcomes for Minnesotans across the state. As Commissioner Kelly indicated, the state-based health insurance tax credit is step two of the governor's plan, and so I will briefly walk you all through the state-based health insurance tax credit before turning it over to my colleague, Commissioner Lori. The state-based health insurance tax credit will ensure that enrollees in the individual market pay no more than approximately 10% of their income on health insurance premiums. Over 45,000 Minnesotans are expected to be able to qualify for the credit by 2023, and this includes over 34,000 individual Minnesotans who are already on that individual market but are above the 400% of the federal poverty levels and so are not able to receive the federal tax credit. And because of this tax credit, we estimate that over 13,000 uninsured Minnesotans who are not yet participating in the market, likely due to costs, will join that market and enroll in coverage to receive the credit. Individuals will be required to enroll in health insurance through MNsure in order to qualify for the tax credit. And right now, over 100,000 Minnesotans purchase their individual coverage through MNsure, and those enrollees include students, self-employed, including farmers, entrepreneurs, sole proprietorships, older adults, and families that do not have access to employer-provided insurance. And currently, Minnesotans with an annual income in excess of 400% of the federal poverty guideline do not qualify for state or federal assistance when they enroll in those qualified health plans through MNsure. These Minnesotans pay the full premium for health insurance coverage. And so for a little bit of context about that income level, 400% of the federal poverty guideline for an individual in 2019 is $49,960. And for a family of four, it's $103,000. The state-based health insurance tax credit would be available to those very individuals whose households with, again, an annual income that exceeds 400% of the federal poverty guidelines. The credit is based on the cost of a benchmark plan in an individual's rating area and the federal affordability percentage, which is currently 9.8% of income. And so this credit will ensure that Minnesotans are not paying more than 9.8% of their income for their health insurance premiums that they purchase on the Minnesota in the MNsure market. So as an example, using the state based tax credit and the premiums that were available in 2019, for a 61-year-old in St. Cloud with an income of $55,000, they would enroll, if they enrolled in a silver plan, that monthly premium would be $693. As Commissioner Kelly noted, this plan includes that 20% subsidy that he described. This individual would receive a credit of $316 and reduce their monthly premiums to $377. For a couple in Anoka with an income of $75,000, if they enroll in a bronze plan with a monthly premium of $1,000, they would receive a credit of $593, reducing their monthly premiums to $428. So as you can see, this would greatly help affordability, and there is an automatic mechanism in the design of this credit to really target it to people who need it most, and it does automatically phase out, because at some point when the premium costs are no longer are under 9.8% of your income, then you will no longer have access to the credit. And so the slide describes the phase outs for the income levels of people who would be eligible for the credit and the amounts of an example individual. Similar to the federal credit that is available in Minnesota for households between 200 and 400% of the federal poverty guidelines, the state-based credit can be paid in advance when the household enrolls in insurance, starting with plan year 2021. If they choose to do this, consumers can apply and enroll in health insurance through MNsure and request to receive an advance payment of the tax credit applied directly to their premium. The estimated credit will be that amount, and will be the estimated credit amount will be paid directly to the health insurance company, and the household will have a reduction in the premiums that they paid during the plan year. Providing this financial support on top of the premium subsidy will help consumers purchase health insurance that they can actually use. With this financial support from the state, consumers will be able to shop for a health plan that will fit their needs rather than being forced into high deductible plans that they are afraid to use. If the consumer does not want to have the credit paid directly to the insurance provider, the credit can also be claimed on the state income tax return as a refundable tax credit. The consumer must still enroll in a health plan through MNsure and pay premiums and claim the credit when they file their state income tax return. Using the same model as the federal premium tax credit provides some familiarity to taxpayers, and the taxpayer can use their state individual income tax return to claim the credit, so they will not have to file a separate claim for this refund. They will file it with their regular income taxes. If the consumers used an advance credit option, the Department of Revenue will review income and the advance payment information and reconcile that as a part of the individual income tax filing process. So the department will issue refunds for any unclaimed or unpaid credits and recoup any additional overpayment of that advanced payment. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. That's a brief description of the tax credit that is available that the governor has proposed as a part of this three-step process to ensure market stability for the individual market. And I'm now going to turn it over to my colleague, Commissioner Laurie.
All right. Thank you very much, Commissioner Bowerly. We appreciate it. And please stay if you can so that if there are questions for members on your portion. Commissioner Laurie, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. It's good to be back before your committee. I am Tony Laurie, the Commissioner of the Department of Human Services, and I have with me today Dave Greenman with the Budget Analyst Division at DHS. He's going to cover a couple of the nuts and bolts, the number slides as we get to them. You know, on slide one here, I think we're okay. Well, I think Governor Walz actually says it best. You know, I really liked how he described what Minnesotans are looking for from their health system is, number one, not to get sick. And number two, if they get sick, you know, not to be overly exposed to the cost so that they're not risking bankruptcy. And then also, we need to make sure that people aren't making these difficult decisions between paying rent and affording their medications or their premiums for health insurance. And that's why the state pursued a reinsurance program in 2017 as a way to provide short-term fix to the rising cost of premiums for people on the individual market who could not get coverage through their employer. However, reinsurance is not and never was intended to be a long-term solution. In fact, we now know, and I think it was really helpful to have Commissioner Malcolm sort of set the stage about the market landscape, and Commissioner Kelly talk about some of the history of how we, you know, backed into this, and then Commissioner Bowerly talk about some of the state-based tax credit options as we move forward. But now, through looking at it, we know that this short-term solution is not the best deal in terms of making the best return on investment for stabilizing the individual market. So despite providing some short-term relief for people in the individual market, the reinsurance has reduced federal funding for the state's health care programs for low to middle income Minnesotans by $90.5 million in plan year 2018 alone. And keeping reinsurance in place as a longer-term solution puts this important program, Minnesota Care, at increasing risk as it moves on. So today, we're going to try to cover for the DHS portion, we're going to talk about the financing basics of Minnesota Care. We're going to talk about the interaction and the downstream impact that reinsurance has on our future financing of the Minnesota Care program, and why, as an administration, Governor Walz, Lieutenant Governor Flanagan proposed a multi-pronged and tailored approach to address the healthcare challenges facing Minnesotans all across our state, and not just extend this short-term Band-Aid known as reinsurance. So the Minnesota Care financing history. With the ACA came a new landscape for healthcare coverage and Minnesota Care. And truthfully, one of the reasons we have all four of these commissioners is post-ACA, you know, public programs, health care is not looked at solely through the lens of Minnesota Department of Human Services, separate from the Department of Commerce that did the individual market historically, separate from the Department of Health who looked at, I mean, we're all in this together now, and we need a concerted effort. And
Commissioner, if I could just stop you for a second.
Yes.
ACA, although we probably all
Affordable
know what it
Care
is.
Affordable Care Act, I'm sorry.
Otherwise known as Obamacare.
Otherwise known as Obamacare.
I just want to make sure people know what we're talking about. Thank you.
Hang any title you want on it. I'm going to continue to call it ACA, I think. But, yes, it is the Affordable Care Act. It is Obamacare. It goes by many names. So pre-ACA, Minnesota Care was an 1115 waiver program under medical assistance, the Medicaid program at the Fed, and was financed with enrollee premiums plus expenditures from our state's health care access fund, which was then matched with federal funds at a matching rate of 50% for those that we could match. But under the ACA, the Affordable Care Act, many of the people covered in the original Minnesota Care program under that 1115 waiver became newly eligible for medical assistance under the Medicaid expansion that Minnesota adopted. And states also, under the Affordable Care Act, had the option of establishing what's known as a basic health program, a BHP, for people who were above income limits for medical assistance, but did not make enough money to afford the health care premiums, even with the advanced premium tax credits and cost-sharing reductions that were available through the marketplaces. So in 2015, with our history of supporting Minnesota Care, Minnesota became the very first state in the country to take up the option of a basic health program option. This meant that federal funding mechanism for Minnesota, as it historically was known, was no longer available through that that historic 1115 waiver process. Instead, Minnesota began receiving Medicaid matching funds through the BHP formula, which netted, which was 95% of what consumers otherwise would have experienced in advanced premium tax credits and cost-sharing reductions that would have flowed through to the enrollees had they purchased their insurance product on the exchange. The remaining cost of the program was funded through the Healthcare Access Fund and enrollee premiums, again, still as the historic piece went, but the federal funds flow through that BHP formula, 95% of advanced premium tax credits, cost-sharing reductions that would have incurred had people bought on the exchange. So Minnesota Care financing today, Minnesota Care's federal funding is based on the cost of the benchmark plan, which is the second lowest silver premium sold on the exchange for the enrollees' age and region in which they're shopping. So that's why it's the BHP formula of how much money Minnesota gets through the feds is very sensitive to the sticker price of the premium on the exchange. If the premiums on the exchange go up on for the second lowest silver, the federal reimbursement goes up. If they go down, the federal reimbursement goes down. And under the current structure that we have, about 87% of Minnesota CARES federal funding currently comes through this BHP formula based on the advanced premium tax credits and cost-sharing reductions. The remaining cost of Minnesota CARE is funded through the revenue in the Healthcare Access Fund from the provider tax, as well as enrollee premiums for the 83,000 people covered in Minnesota CARE today. Then we're going to kind of talk about some of the detailed numbers and how they work.
Sure. Madam Chair, Dave Greenman with the Department of Human Services.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Greenman.
Thank you. And Commissioner Lori, I think, covered well the importance of the advanced premium tax credits in terms of funding Minnesota CARE and how important those are and how sensitive the basic health program is to changes in premiums in the individual market. And then Senator Kelly, or Commissioner Kelly,
let's go back a ways. I don't know. Maybe you
okay. Commissioner Kelly talked about the 1332 waiver that the state requested through the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services that would have allowed the state to receive the same level of advanced premium tax credits as we would have received without reinsurance for both the individual market and the basic health plan. And what this would be referred to then as pass-through funding, where we would allow the state to repurpose the federal funds, not get new federal funds, but repurpose the federal funds that we would have received without the reinsurance waiver. Commissioner Kelly mentioned, CMS only approved the pass-through funding for the coverage in the individual market and did not allow it to be applied to the BHP. Because of that limited waiver approval, that reduced premiums resulting from the reinsurance means that the premiums reduced premiums resulting from the reinsurance caused a reduction in our federal funding for the BHP. And in plan year 2018, as a result of the federal pass-through funds for the reinsurance pool, we received $130.7 million, while funding for the Minnesota CARE program was reduced by about $90.5 million. And our experience in 2019 has been projected that we'll receive about $84.8 million in federal pass-through funds for the reinsurance program, and we'll experience a loss of about $77 million to the basic health plan. So overall, our experience with reinsurance is projected to be about a loss of about $167.5 million to the basic health plan due to the reinsurance waiver disapproval for the Minnesota CARE program, which represents a loss of about 78% of the reimbursement received under the 1332 waiver for the individual market for the reinsurance plan. As a result of the loss of this federal funding, the BHP will run out of, it's projected to run out of funds sooner, which will put more costs of the Minnesota CARE program onto the Health Care Access Fund sooner than otherwise would have been. So I'll turn it back over to Commissioner Lori.
Commissioner Lori.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, I think it's important to note that back in 2017 when we were debating the reinsurance program, we made it contingent on receiving a federal waiver and did get assurances from the feds that they would give us a pass-through on both the individual market APTC side of the book of business as well as on the Minnesota CARE BHP side of the book of business. And it was a matter of just days before open enrollment started in that fall that we were notified that they were denying us that additional funding. So with that new knowledge, looking at reinsurance and the possibility of restoring it again, it's really important that we look at coverage and costs much more carefully across the entire system, including public programs and the individual market, the combination of them, and look at the federal funding streams through that broader lens. That's why we need a multi-pronged approach that is put forward by the Walz administration that focuses on longer-term solutions that increase access to affordable and comprehensive quality coverage, that helps people afford their medications, that makes sure that they can see the healthcare providers in their own community as well. The Walls Flanagan proposal includes a comprehensive package that will allow the state to bring down premiums next year with the 20% subsidy, and the following year with the state-based tax credit that Commissioner Bowerly described, and as well as reduce the cost of prescriptions and increase access to dental care while creating comprehensive buy-in health coverage options available statewide in the following years. Reinsurance itself does not solve any of these broader challenges Minnesotans are facing today. And we can't address these issues in isolation. We absolutely need to understand the interactions and the connections with other pieces of the system. And that's why Commissioner Malcolm's broader, healthcare marketplace was really an important backdrop to this whole thing. The impact on the state budget is important, but most importantly, the impact on the people of Minnesota and making sure that we're doing best for the people of Minnesota. So when looking at the choice between reinsurance or the governor's multi-pronged approach, both bring down premiums for those earning over 400% of federal poverty level and those in the family glitch. However, unlike reinsurance, the governor's proposal doesn't reduce the amount of federal funding available to the state for running our Minnesota Care program for low and middle income Minnesotans, and just extending reinsurance also doesn't lead us to being able to have the resources to further limit premiums to the about 9.9% of income. And the Walls Flanagan One Care package actually begins making some of the substantial changes in areas where we know health care isn't working for the people of Minnesota. Bringing down premiums for people, reducing the cost of prescription drugs, increasing access to dental care much more locally, as well as creating comprehensive buy-in health coverage options for people statewide, and then in particular for areas where choice begins to disappear. So that's the DHS version.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Commissioner Lurie, for that presentation. So we have reached the end of our prepared presentations. We're going to open it up for member questions, and I'm going to ask members to, we have about 20 minutes for questions, and then I'm going to ask Commissioner Malcolm to come back up and say a few words at the end. So we are making a list here. I'm going to ask members to just ask one question unless there's a very brief follow-up, and then you can certainly get back on the list, but I want to make sure that all the members on the committee get an opportunity to ask a question. So, Representative Grunhagen, you are first.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, my question would be for Commissioner Kelly. On your presentation, I'm just looking at page 13. And you can correct me if you think I'm wrong and respond, but just a couple of observations. I see several fallacies in this presentation. One is, with the reinsurance, you show the premiums to stay the same. Well, we know with reinsurance, we saw about a 20% average drop in the market. So premiums could go down again with the reinsurance program versus the premium that you're listing there. The second observation is that it appears this plan, the governor's plan, actually wants higher in health insurance premiums with their subsidy. You know, we under reinsurance, the money goes to pay claims. Under this premium subsidy, we're actually giving money, in most cases, unless you file a federal tax return for the credit, right to the insurance companies. And I think that's a problem with the plan. And finally, by driving up the premiums of individual health insurance, last observation, we know that MinSure is supported by a 3.5% tax on the premiums offered through the MinSure website. Also, the information I have, MinSure is down to about 1 month of funding, okay? So it appears like we're driving up health insurance premiums just to bail out the operation of MinSure with the additional higher revenue of the 3.5% tax on higher individual health insurance premiums. Okay. And how that helps Minnesota, I'm not quite sure.
All right. Representative Gruenhagen, I think that was actually three questions.
That's three observations.
I'm going to let Representative Kelly respond, and I kind of think you used up your follow-up. I'm sorry, Commissioner Kelly. And I think you used up your follow-up. So go ahead, Commissioner.
I'll defer to your judgment.
Madam Chair and Representative Gruenhagen, I may not have been clear enough in my initial presentation regarding this slide. The slide on the left, as you can see in the cream-colored band in the middle, assumes reinsurance is in place. So this participant on the left is benefiting from the reinsurance program, and that's why you see that a premium total of $367 on the left. The individual on the right now is not benefiting from reinsurance, is instead benefiting from the 20% premium subsidy. And you can see that the individual pays the same amount. In both cases, the money flows from the state to the plans. The reinsurance payments, money flows from the state to the plan based on whether the plans hit the attachment point and cost-sharing levels. In the right-hand side, the money flows to the plan based on the number of people that they have signed up, and they get the 20% discount flowing to the plan that then is reflected in the invoice that goes to the consumer. So this shows that the effect is the same. And I will, and Representative Gruenhagen, with respect to your last point, some of my colleagues may have some observations on that. But from the point of view of the analysis of the department, the principal reason to go to the subsidy plan is the effect on the flow of federal funds to Minnesotans and to the state through the maintenance of the federal tax credit and the additional benefits coming to the basic health plan by using the subsidy program. That is the principal benefit we see, and that is the only conversation I've had about the benefits of the subsidy program compared to the reinsurance program.
All right, thank you.
Couple clarifications.
No. Representative Gruenhagen, because we've got a list here. So let me just tell you all. We have Munson, Schultz, Mann, Neuer, Baker, Haley, and Loeffler. And we have about 15 minutes or so for and Schumacher. So
okay.
We're going to give everyone a chance.
Response.
So, well, that's fine. You can disagree. Representative Munson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm excited to have the Commissioners of Human Services and Health and Commerce and Department of Revenue, and I'd love to spend 5 hours in a room with you guys and I hammer out this issue. I'm new to the legislature. I lost my insurance in 2017 because I was outpriced in the private market. I'm from rural Minnesota. The premiums for my family of four were $26,000 a year with a $13,300 deductible, and we opted to go without insurance. And there's a lot of people in my district that did the same thing. There are a lot of people that have insurance plans with high deductibles, and they're afraid to go to the doctor because they don't know what things are going to cost. In all of these presentations today, you're talking about shifting money around for insurance and how we can subsidize this and subsidize that, especially when we're talking about people who are above 400% of the poverty level. Those are our taxpayers. Those are the people paying the taxes, and you're taking taxes and giving it back to them in the form of subsidies. In none of these plans that I see where we're empowering the consumer, empowering the patient to make choice, having price transparency and competition to help drive down prices and squeeze out greed in the industry between pharmaceutical companies or insurance companies or hospital associations. We need to lower the underlying health care costs as opposed to trying to shift around the insurance that does not lower, that doesn't put downward pressure on the prices. So, and I guess to the Commissioner of Commerce, Commissioner Kelly, is there anything in your plans that help introduce more competition in some free markets to push down prices, or do you completely disregard that in when I have no pricing in the industry so that we have no selection and no choice and let the insurance and pharmaceutical lobbies just continue to jack the prices?
Well, there's a lot there. Commissioner Kelly, or
Madam Chair,
wants to answer to.
I'll lead off since the last part of the question was addressed to me. Madam Chair and Representative Munson, it is true that this proposal focuses on stabilizing the individual market for insurance and does not address directly the challenge of underlying costs. I'll turn it over to Commissioner Malcolm because she touched on some of the potential differences in incentives related to different approaches. I will say that at least in our conversations, all four of us, as well as the governor and lieutenant governor, are concerned about what we can do about those underlying costs. But the focus on this is on ensuring the stability of the individual insurance market, and you are correct that the premium subsidy proposal by itself does not directly affect those underlying costs.
Commissioner Laurie.
Thank you, and Representative Munson, I haven't had the chance to meet you yet, Commissioner Laurie again. But, you know, one of the pieces that does come in is that we are leveraging the purchasing power of the state. And, you know, we purchase insurance on behalf of 1.2 million Minnesotans. And the first piece where we're really leveraging that buying power is specifically in your first cost driver item, is in pharmaceutical spending. So we're building a single pharmacy benefit set based on our really successful fee-for-service pharmaceutical spend. Over between 2015 and 2017, you know, when we worked with pharma and negotiated with prices and making sure that we had drug utilization that was accessible for the 300,000 people on our fee-for-service program, and made these transactions without the profit motives and above the table with public groups that are working on making sure that we negotiate the best price, rather than under the table with deals that nobody can see. None of us can see the deals that are made below the table. Here's what we do know. In our fee-for-service program, between 2015 and 2017, we had a 2.5% trend on our pharmacy spend. In the managed care, where the transactions are very different and those are the ones that we can't see, we had a 21% trend between 2015 and 2017 in that same space. So we're going to leverage the buying power of the state to negotiate better pharmaceutical prices to build into our One Care package and really start to drive down costs. That's the first piece, and then that actually feeds into the ability to put out the platinum, the lower deductible product statewide that is really intended to be able to be designed to better serve people who know on the front end that they need to use their insurance product to achieve better health for themselves and their families. And so we really are working hard to use the leverage that we have to negotiate better deals on behalf of consumers, and really do look forward to further conversations.
Yeah, and okay, let's go on to the next question, if we could, because I'm cognizant of the time, and I know we really could spend several hours talking about this. I wish we had that time. Unfortunately, we don't have that today. Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I recently read the column by Representative Greg Davids about reinsurance, and I would like some clarification by Commissioners Laurie and Kelly about this. He claims that premiums will skyrocket 50% if reinsurance is not, if it's eliminated, and also claims that under reinsurance, it'll help all of Minnesotans on the program, 160,000, whereas the governor's plan will only help 80,000 people under the premium subsidy program. Can you help clarify that? Are those statements true, or what else do we need to know about those claims?
Commissioner Kelly.
Madam Chair and Representative Schultz, I'll try to tackle the first part of that question. The number 54% appeared in a study by an actuarial consulting firm in last year. First it was comparing 2019 to 2020. And we think comparisons across years we have to be cautious about that because nobody knows what the rate increases are actually going to be. Secondly, that study relied on Massachusetts data rather than Minnesota data, and our actuaries at the Department of Commerce think that was an inappropriate assumption to be using, because Minnesota's experience in a variety of ways is quite different than Massachusetts. And third, we have some concerns about some assumptions that they made regarding the cost of the program that may have affected that 54% number. They assumed that the cost of the program would be $271 million a year, and we know from last year that the actual cost of administering the program was closer to just half that number. So that could be a significant contributor to our difference of opinion regarding that number. But I think the key issue to keep in mind is within the same year, so within 2019, we've seen the effect of the reinsurance program, which is to reduce rates by about 20% from what the without reinsurance rates would be. And we also know that the premium subsidy of 20%, that discount would reduce rates by the same amount. So if we stay within the same year, we can see that that's the effect, and the 54% number changes years, does these other things that we think reduces its reliability.
So I think it was
Commissioner Lurie,
Madam Chair, and Representative Schultz, that Commissioner Kelly, the regulator of health insurance, rates, kind of reiterated that, you know, reinsurance affects a 20% reduction in premiums. So, I mean, if we do a 20% reduction in premiums, we're replicating reinsurance for that population that is actually helped by it. So then it comes to, well, what is the population actually helped by? Reducing the sticker price of reinsurance by 20%. Well, for those consumers who are already protected from the sticker price of the insurance product by advanced premium tax credits, which is the very design of the Affordable Care Act, the reinsurance doesn't actually change their net out-of-pocket cost to purchase that product, because if the rate goes up, their APTC value goes up and keeps them at the same point. So when we use our state dollars to buy down the price point for the entirety of the market, it's not actually helping those, it's not actually reducing the out-of-pocket amount that the APTC consumers would experience to gain access to that coverage that they gain access to. So what we're trying to do is replicate that 20% reduction for those that don't have access to the advanced premium tax credits and cost-sharing reductions available through the exchange. And then the piece that you need to add in to the equation is that when we buy down the premiums for the entirety of the market, remember that benchmark plan, the second lowest silver, we just bought that down by 20% too, and cost ourselves $90.5 million in BHP funding that we otherwise would be eligible for. So that's where it really isn't the best return on investment for the state of Minnesota to buy down the entirety of the premium. It's really to focus on those areas where people are fully exposed, the individuals above 400%. That's a really tough story. And we need to address those areas in a much more targeted fashion while keeping in mind the pieces that we need to focus on and making sure that we bring in the federal money that we're entitled to.
All right. Thank you. Representative Mann.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you to all the commissioners. It seems like we are being almost threatened by insurance companies, right? They're saying, give us state money or we're going to increase your premiums. So my question is, do we know for sure that they would increase premiums if we don't do the reinsurance program? And along those same lines, what kind of accountability measures do we have built into that program so we know the money is going to where it's supposed to go?
Commissioner Kelly.
Madam Chair and Representative Mann, so the Department of Commerce is responsible for analyzing rates presented to the department by the plans, and so from that experience, We have seen that the reinsurance program has had the effect of reducing the rates charged to consumers in the same way that a premium subsidy program would have that same net effect. We have not, so far as I'm aware, seen any signs that the costs reported by the plans have been out of line, which is not to say that we've examined everything thoroughly, but I've not had anybody report to me that there's been a concern about the way the plans have operated under the reinsurance program.
Okay. Representative Neuer.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Commissioners. So under the State Relief and Empowerment Waiver, which is Section 1332, we lost $167 million that will have funded Minnesota Basic Health Plan, which is Minnesota Care, in other words. So by replacing it with reinsurance premium subsidies, we're going to be able to get that money and be able to use it for Minnesota Care. Is that correct?
Commissioner Lurie.
Madam Chair, Representative Neuer, yes. That would restore the federal flow of money to the BHP that was lost under the 1332 reinsurance waiver. Yes, you have that exactly correct.
Yeah.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Thank you. Representative Baker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Commissioners, thank you very much. I think I echo some of the comments here. We're HHS Finance here, and we've got a kind of a new complicated system we want to roll out here, and we've got 8 minutes. And so this isn't the right amount of time to talk about this. My concern and my complete heartburn now is I saw the reinsurance was a good program. It is a Band-Aid. We're not getting to the underlying cost of health care. I think everything that's been said I agree to. And we're still even looking at your system as a bit of a temporary system, maybe 3 years out. Or 4 years out, and we've got to get this under control, but we don't think it's going to be a short-term deal. My concern is just coming off of seeing two commissioners sitting there in transportation talking about MNLARS and talking about an IT system that's going to have to be built on this system to track premium subsidies, to track refunds, to track all these things about how we're going to build something new. Who is going to run that? Who's going to be in charge of that new system? And how quickly does that have to be up and running before you let the new numbers out this summer, Commissioner? So I'm just concerned about the IT issue of this because I don't want to keep going back there, but isn't this reinsurance plan, it's a lot simpler. It doesn't require this massive IT FTE loaded system that we're likely going to do if you get your way. I just have to say, haven't we learned enough to say maybe we ought to still keep working on the underlying problems of our health care system, but at least this Band-Aid buys us time without putting a bunch of new costs on top of this system with an IT bill.
And I, just before you answer, and I don't know who's going to answer, Commissioner Byerly maybe, I just want to say we don't have a bill in front of us today, so we are not. This is not the end of the conversation. This is just part of the conversation.
But, Madam Chair, only to that, this is the governor's wish. I assume this is going to be something coming. That's why I want to make sure we address this head on.
You bet. Representative Byerly. Commissioner Byerly.
Thank you. You might recall my uncle, Representative Bowerly from 18B, 20 years ago. Chair Liebling and Representative Baker. So I assure you that when state agencies undertake a change of our systems, we think about that very carefully. And you will notice as we walk through these proposals that there is a phase-in to how we do this work. And that is because we want to ensure that we do get the technology right. So I can't speak fully for my colleague at MNSURE, but of course MNSURE will work to ensure that the subsidy program is in place for this next plan year. And then the next layer is the state premium tax credit. So the Department of Revenue will update our systems as we do each year when there is a tax change. We've been operating on the same system for about a decade, and we know how to upgrade that system and make changes to it. And so there are thoughtful plans, and I understand the source of your concern, and it is a source of of interest and thoughtful planning on behalf of every agency when we undertake these changes. And so you will, and then you will see that the next phase is the One Care system. And of course, all of these will need to build upon each other. And so we have been planful as we have laid out this proposal by the governor to ensure that we can deliver on the promises that this plan makes for Minnesota families.
And thank you. And Commissioner Laurie, did you want to say something in addition to that point? We don't have anyone from Minsher here, but you know, in terms of the piece that goes to Minsher and their ability to do the technology of it, Commissioner Laurie?
Yeah. So from the Minsher perspective, this first phase is actually one of the easier ones to implement. It is a very it's a binary decision point. Is the individual that is purchasing through our exchange eligible for advanced premium tax credits or not? And this is an item that Minsher already knows in their existing system. If the answer is yes, they are eligible for advanced premium tax credits, then they wouldn't actually benefit from the subsidy. If the answer is no, that's when the subsidy kicks in. And that's why that is the very first phase, as Commissioner Bowerly said. We're trying to phase this in a way that's able to be sensitive to the IT needs of actually standing up a program of this magnitude. And understand your concerns very, very well.
All right.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. And members, we're going to go a few minutes over because I want to try to let at least the members who haven't spoken be able to ask a question. So, Representative Haley.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Commissioners. I need to go back to the slides on 8 and 9. I think this was Commissioner Kelly's presentation here. I'm still confused about how we're characterizing the BHP and the potential loss of BHP funding. And it's a little bit like when my sisters and I were teenagers and we'd go shopping at Dayton's for a new sweater, and we'd say to my dad, well, it was 60, but we only paid 30. We saved you $30. And he would say, girls, you can't spend money you don't have, and you didn't save money that you didn't actually, you know. So that's how this is looking to me. We're pointing out money that the state didn't really get, and then now saying we can put that back into the equation. And maybe I'm misunderstanding it. This is a complex component here. So, and perhaps you need to follow up with me. I want to know how much money the state had in surplus in the BHP fund to begin with. Because of this perverse relationship, as our rates go up, they get more money into that bucket. So we're almost incented not to reduce premiums into that bucket. But we also had enough money in the basic health plan, is my understanding. And we also, and if I'm not right, tell me, we were able to use the BHP dollars in order and to use the health care access fund to pay for MA funding. So these funding streams crisscross at some point as well, and I know that's a lot in there, but I don't believe these slides are really depicting the full story here.
Commissioner Kelly.
Madam Chair and Representative Haley, I think in light of your question and in light of Commissioner Laurie's testimony, I think you're right. This slide does not represent balances in the basic health plan or other resources that Commissioner Laurie was referencing. This slide is intended only to take 1 year and show what would have happened, what did happen, and then what would have happened under two alternative scenarios in the same year. And just representing the annual flow of funds, not any balances in any accounts. So this had a very limited purpose. And I don't think your sweater analogy is quite apt, but it's thoughtful in terms of trying to think about this. So it is correct that if the stated rate from the health plan is higher, that leads to a higher federal premium tax credit flowing to those Minnesotans who are eligible for that tax credit. For those who are not eligible for that tax credit, we would then have the premium subsidy reducing their net cost. And because we know from 2017 that the subsidy program did not reduce the basic health plan funding the way the reinsurance program does, we project in the blue side the positive flow to the state of having the higher stated premium amount and then recovering the BHP funding that we have lost in 2018 and 2019. So that's the effort. And you might be right that the design of the federal program supports the states having higher stated rates, but our end goal is the amount that individuals actually pay. And I don't think there's any difference between the supporters of reinsurance or the supporters of the governor's premium subsidy program. We both want Minnesotans paying in the end as low an amount as we can enable them to do it with a reasonable amount of dollars. And we believe both get us to the same place.
Okay. Thank you, Commissioner. Representative Loeffler, and we are over, so if members can be brief, it would be great. And if the answers could be a little brief.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We've heard a lot of information, and it's really exciting to have four agencies working together on this, because in the past, I think we've been confused as we hear one from perspective from one and one from another. So thank you for that. I just want to make sure that I'm putting all the key points together. And so what I have is, as you compare the governor or administration's plan versus reinsurance, the governor's plan helps more people because it helps people both below and above 400% of poverty, while the reinsurance is only targeted at those over 400%. That it provides an additional $96 million in federal funding to help with the cost of Minnesota care, and that it keeps the full incentive for health plans to coordinate care and reduce costs for those who have multiple chronic conditions, where under the reinsurance plan, the health insurance plan only picks up 20%, so there's less of a financial incentive. Is that kind of a good summary, and have I lost something? You went through a lot.
Mr. Lurie?
Madam Chair, Representative Loeffler, a short answer. Yeah, that captures it pretty well.
Very good. Thank you. Good short question, short answer. Representative Schumacher.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I know that our members definitely have plenty more questions. I understand that your setup for today, the questions for you, the setup today was just to kind of introduce us to the topic and let it sink in a little bit, and we'll be going forward with this. I was just wondering if there will be bills that will be presented, if this will be just part of the omnibus bill and we'll discuss it then, or what your intentions are.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Schumacher. There is a bill, House File 3, that I'm carrying that has many of the elements of this in it. It doesn't have the state-level tax credit, and I don't think it has the 20% discount in it either, but it has the more the health care pieces of it. That bill is going to be heard at some point in this committee, so we will have a hearing on that. And these other pieces will be heard, I believe, in the tax committee, because they're more there. So, I mean, everything will get a full hearing. We also will be hearing the governor's budget bill, the entire thing, although we'll focus on things, other parts of it, on Thursday. So we'll have an actual hearing on that bill and with the intention of laying it over for possible inclusion, but we'll have more discussion about more of what's in it on Thursday of this week. So thank you for that question. And so I'm going to just wrap it up now, ask a quick question myself, and then let Commissioner Malcolm kind of close up here because we are over time. And it hasn't really been made clear, but when we talk about these two, my understanding, and just tell me if I'm understanding this right, when under the current reinsurance program, we're talking about a 20% reduction, but that 20% is an average, right? So it's my understanding that under the current program that some consumers are actually saw their insurance premiums, what they paid, go up. So this is when you, so we keep talking about 20%, but this is not affecting everyone the same. Under the governor's plan, however, 20% is 20%, and that is the same for everyone. So under the governor's program, we at least know that every consumer is getting a discount, and the consumer can see what that is. Whereas under the current plan, the consumer, it's not transparent to the consumer, and it's going affecting different people differently. Is that a correct assessment? Commissioner Kelly.
Madam Chair, I believe that is correct. It's not a question I've asked in quite that way, but that that is consistent. It is fair to say that we are talking about averages with respect to the reinsurance program, and I don't, especially since it shows up on the invoice, that 20% should be consistent across consumers, but I don't want to totally discount the possibility that there's some averaging in there, too.
Okay, thank you. And, you know, and that, of course, brings us to the point, too, that this is something that the consumer will see on their bill, and, in fact, they won't be paying that 20%, correct? This is a discount that will come right off the bottom line, and it will never come out of their pocket.
Madam Chair, that is correct.
All right, thank you. Commissioner Malcolm.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thanks again for giving us this time to kind of talk about these issues in a little bit more holistic context than we sometimes do. I just want to mention we appreciate your questions. I think Representative Munson, Representative Baker, and others have underscored the point that ultimately we really need to get to talking about how are we going to bring down the cost of healthcare itself, the drivers of insurance premiums, and buy more health for Minnesotans with the precious resources that we're investing in it. We're starting with a discussion about how to stabilize the individual market. Though it is a small part of our state's insurance market, it's an important one. And in a certain sense, it's like the canary in the coal mine. I mean, because people in the individual insurance market are directly facing the cost pressures that most of us who have the benefit of employer-supported insurance or publicly financed insurance are not facing the same cost pressures as these 155,000 Minnesotans. So it's right that you are spending so much time and that we're spending time on how to subsidize this small and somewhat inherently unstable market, but we know that whatever we come up with, we should approach the market stability in the most straightforward, cost-effective way. I think Commissioner Lurie's used the term, what's the return on investment for the state dollars that we're putting into stabilizing the market so that we can keep the resources available to all the other ways in which we're trying to support health care improvement in Minnesota, also working in that direction. But we want you to know that we, commissioners who touch these issues, and the governor and the lieutenant governor, are fully aware that this is a long-term, bigger project that we have to figure out how to stabilize the market overall and how to get more value for our health spending. And we intend to keep working on that with you over the interim and for years to come. And we just thank you for your time today.
All right. Well, Commissioner Bowerly, Commissioner Malcolm, Commissioner Lurie, Commissioner Kelly, thank you very much for your presentations today. To the committee, we are going to be in recess now until 5 o'clock or call of the chair. We're going to take up some bills this evening. I hope that we'll be pretty quick, not take up your whole night tonight, but we will be in recess until 5 o'clock or call of the chair. Thank you. The Health and Human Services Finance Division will reconvene, and we're going to call First House File 1985, Representative Hornstein. Which one? Welcome to the committee, Representative Hornstein.
Thank you very much, Representative Liebling.
The chair will move House File 1985 to be laid over for possible inclusion in the HHS Division Omnibus Bill. So, Representative Hornstein, go ahead and present your bill.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair and members. House File 1985 comes to me from a wonderful nonprofit organization called Ready, Set, Smile. And this is an organization that is working very hard to address the growing disparities in dental care between folks with means and low-income people, and people of color, and particularly low-income children. And so the bill expands medical assistance coverage for the application of fluoride varnish, which is known to be highly effective at preventing cavities and, of course, for proper oral health. And so this is really the new language is on page 2, and I do have a couple of testifiers who work in this field and would be happy to provide their expertise.
Okay, Representative Hornstein, if you're so, did you want to call up your provider?
Yeah, I think it would be helpful to the committee. They know a little bit more about this than I do, so they've come, and I don't know what your policy is, but they could be very brief.
Okay, we will sure, and we would really ask everyone to confine their remarks to just 1 or 2 minutes, if they could.
The two testifiers a minute each, perhaps.
Sure, my town.
Would you be willing to testify?
Absolutely.
Thank you so much.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, welcome to the committee. Please give us your name and if you're affiliated with anybody, and then just go ahead and give us your testimony.
Yes, my name is Robert Jones, DDS, PhD. I'm an associate professor at the University of Minnesota, Division of Pediatric Dentistry. I fully support this bill. I'm here just for 4 quick points. One, the research supports the efficacy of this approach to reduce cavities in children. The research also shows high safety with this approach. In fact, one of the facts about this approach is to target the fluoride to reduce the total amount of fluoride that somebody's getting each day. So this is a professional application. The other thing I want to mention in terms of efficacy is that we now know in the last 10 years that we can manage early cavities with topical fluorides in addition to other prevention measures so that we don't have to drill out dental decay. This should lead to lower overall cavities in children, lower suffering and pain in children, lower missed school days in children, and ultimately be a cost-effective method. And my last point I will make, because I do respect your time, is that the dental fillings and the dental restorations that medical assistants put so much money into reimbursing, a majority of these restorations do not prevent future decay. It doesn't. I come from a research background, and it does not really change bacterial levels, these restorations, and so we have a chronic cycle of dental decay in children.
All right. Thank you. Representative Baker
Madam
has
Chair,
a question.
And maybe to the testifier, if I could, Madam Chair. We've got a University of Minnesota Dental Clinic out in Wilmer.
Yeah.
Under your purview, and wondering this, I assume this fluoride was being used now. Is that not the case? And can you just tell me, especially with children, I know how important this is. Why does this bill change that if it's funded or it's not being used now?
It is being used. What we have found from the research is that there is a dose response. Right now, we can do 2 applications a year. This bill says that high-risk individuals who have high caries risk or a risk of getting cavities could get 4 applications a year. And the research supports this dose response to increase this fluoride, targeted fluoride, would improve oral health in children. So it is being used in our University of Minnesota clinics.
Thank you.
Yep.
Thank you. Other questions? And I have a question. How
yes.
is high risk defined?
Yeah, from what that bill states is that there are different different types of questionnaires that take into account the physical evidence that you see from a patient plus their health-promoting habits or lack of health-promoting habits that they're reporting, and that there is a there are validated questionnaires that assess whether somebody's at a high or lower risk for dental decay. This would be similar to cardiovascular disease or other types of medical diseases.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Yep.
All right. Representative Kunesh-Podein.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Madam Chair. And my question is, so what's the earliest age you would start doing something like this?
Dr. Jones.
Yes. So you would do this as early as 12 months of age, depending on the caries risk, risk for getting cavities. So somebody with low cavity risk, you do not have to give this targeted therapy. So you would wait. So we see a lot of children that have, decay as early as 1 to 2 years of age. And so we have to sedate these children. We have to put them under general anesthesia. And we're not actually preventing the disease from reoccurring. So this would give us the tools, the additional tools, to manage that type of decay.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Right. Representative Olson.
Madam Chair, just really quick, I mean, this is a good bill, and I didn't realize until reading just quickly in the fiscal note how many kiddos this would impact. I mean, this is a pretty significant amount of kids that would be able to hopefully have preventative care that would then, and we know that dental care in the MA population is an issue, and so this is seems like a small bill, but is actually quite significant in reaching a number of kids that would really need it. So I just want to draw attention to that and say thank you, Representative Hornstein, for bringing it forward.
Okay, other discussion. All right, I'm not seeing any. Is there another testifier, Representative Hornstein?
I don't know.
Okay.
And Madam Chair, I don't know if he's on your list, but I ran into an old friend who I haven't seen in many years, but he strongly opposes my bill, and I think he may want to testify, but. He's here, Mr. Cashman. But are you interested in Dallin testifying? Okay. So I don't know if you have room for an opponent, but he is available.
Well, Representative Hornstein, I said, you know, we will take testimony from the public, but it's got to be just 1 or 2 minutes. And we do have a letter in our packet from Mr. Cashman.
Oh.
So, Mr. Cashman, if you could please give your name, whatever, if you're affiliated with anyone, and then please keep your comments brief.
Okay. Leo B. Cashman. Been executive director of a nonprofit group called DAMS, Dental Amalgam Mercury Solutions. And we educate the public on less toxic options in dentistry. We are critics of the more toxic substances used in dentistry, primarily what comes up is mercury and fluoride, both very, very very toxic elements. I want to point to the fiscal note, which only describes benefits and doesn't describe the harm, but I think that's very inaccurate and misleading. We have the fact that fluoride harms teeth through a process called dental fluorosis. And as the timeline for dental exposure has gone up over the last few decades, so has dental fluorosis, which is damage to the teeth. You see the chalky white spots on the surface. When that's happening, it's happening throughout the tooth, and actually it's a marker of damage to the bones and the connective tissue in the body.
Mr. Cashman, this is really off the topic of the bill, which is about topical fluoride.
Madam Chair, the other testifier talked about risk, and I am in a position, but that his, well, because there's a fiscal note, and if we have systemic damage, then there should be an inclusion of systemic damage caused by this poison in the fiscal note. Am I right?
No, you're wrong, Mr. Cashman. Our fiscal notes do not include that kind of information. So that would
well,
not be in a fiscal note.
I think that a fiscal note that only implies that there are benefits and there's no harm by using a very toxic substance, fluoride is more toxic than lead, not quite as toxic as arsenic, is an insufficient fiscal note, and I would ask other committee members if they might agree with that. I would love to hear if any committee members at all in this room think that harm to the brain, to the connective tissue, to the thyroid, all the things linked to fluoride toxicity are irrelevant to a fiscal note. We have heard a lot of testimony in this committee about preventative health and preventing problems. I totally agree, and I'm just saying let's include the damage, the harm done by one of the really toxic things used in dentistry and not overlook it. That is not serving the people of Minnesota to do that. And I would like other committee members to weigh in and see if they agree. They might agree on that point.
Well, Mr. Cashman, thank you. I think your time is concluded.
Thank you. I can answer questions too. The other gentleman answered questions. I'm available.
No questions for you, Mr. Cashman. Thank you.
No questions allowed.
Oh, there are no questions. I haven't seen anyone raise their hand, so thank you.
Thank you very much.
Do you have any other testifiers, Representative?
No, I don't. There are other supporters, but I do really appreciate the committee's time. I think is well worth it, and thank you very much for considering playing this bill over.
All right. Is there any discussion from the committee? All right. Seeing none, the chair will renew my motion that House File 1985 be laid over for possible inclusion in the HHS Omnibus Finance Omnibus Bill. Thank you, Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Okay. All right. The next bill that we will take up is House File 1239, Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And the chair will move that House File 1239 be recommended for re-referral to Ways and Means. Please present your bill.
Thank you, Chair, members. Minnesotans get their drinking water from one of three sources, private wells, municipal wells, or surface water like the Mississippi River. Altogether, about 25 to 30% of Minnesotans get their drinking water from surface water served by about 25 waterworks. The Minnesota Department of Health does not test surface water that will be used for drinking water contaminants. It does not require waterworks to do so. Waterworks are required to test their water once it's been treated, but the group of chemicals that EPA requires were identified before 1996. The U.S. EPA has not added even one chemical since 1996, in spite of the fact that current science has identified a number of new contaminants that are showing up in drinking water sources. So basically, you can't manage what you don't measure. So House File 1239 does two things. It provides money for the Department of Health to test for drinking water contaminants in surface water that is used for drinking water, and provides money to develop standards for contaminants that are likely found in surface waters. So I'm going to use as an example the Mississippi River and just tell you quickly about some of the things going on there. So Minneapolis and St. Paul, which serves some of its suburbs, take their water from the Mississippi just north of the Minneapolis border. our drinking water intakes are about 20 miles south of where the Crow River enters the Mississippi. And keep that in mind as I tell you about a chemical that has the shorthand name of NDMA. That is a highly toxic, potent, cancer-causing chemical that has been found in the Minneapolis and St. Paul drinking water systems. It was first detected during some testing in 2008 and 2009, and the highest test was found to be 16 times higher than the Department of Health's health-based guidance value, a guidance value that only considers increased risk for cancer and not the potential for developmental effects. And, of course, developmental effects are what you think of when you think about kids. The Department of Health did nothing more about NDMA after the 2008-2009 testing. The Crow and the Mississippi have some of the highest levels of the chemicals that form NDMH that have been seen. Most of the toxicity occurs in the distribution system, but since there's only a non-regulatory health guidance value, there's really a disincentive to look for it. PCA has invested a lot of money up in checking up on the Crow, but it does not check up for drinking water contaminants. There is a TMDL report that says that the Crow has a high level of fecal bacteria. The South Crow flows into the Crow before it reaches the Mississippi, and it has the highest concentrations of nitrogen and phosphorus of all the streams in the Mississippi River Basin. The North Fork of the Crow also has high nitrate levels. And while the PCA does not check for pesticides, the Department of Agriculture's own data show that where there are high nitrogen levels, there will be high pesticide levels. There are 60 wastewater facilities in the relatively small Crow watershed, and there's a map in your packet that shows where they are. In 2011, the PCA issued a report quantifying endocrine-disrupting chemicals both upstream and downstream from water treatment plants. The most frequently detected contaminants were bisphenol A, a contraceptive hormone, a common antibiotic, and an anti-seizure medication used to treat attention deficit disorders. In October of 2016, the PCA issued a report about pharmaceuticals and chemicals of concern in the rivers. And this is what the subtitle of the report says, and I'm quoting here. An extensive study of Minnesota rivers and streams reveals that several commonly used pharmaceuticals and other commercial chemicals are present in the state, most of the state's flowing waters. These contaminants were found to have measurable effects on fish exposed to them in the river. End quote. One of the 50 randomly selected sites was the Crow River. It had the second highest number of detections of pharmaceuticals and chemicals of concern, more than the Minnesota River. You can see that on the other map that I handed out. Minnesota state agencies have spent roughly $117 million of clean water legacy money over the past 10 years testing and analyzing the nitrogen and phosphorus and sediment as they begin to work on these problems. The Department of Agriculture has spent about $25 million of clean water money to test private wells in vulnerable areas for nitrogen and pesticide. The Department of Health has received clean water money to make plans for protecting municipal wells, but it has received virtually nothing to test surface waters that are used for drinking water, and that's the most likely contaminated of all of our water sources. And this bill remedies that gap. I could go over the bill a little bit, or I could take questions, either one.
Thank you, Representative Wargenius. I think there is a question, and why don't we do a couple questions. Representative Munson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Wagenius. My question is on your bill on page 4 in subdivision 5 on lines 13 to 17, where it says that if the commissioner, and this is the, I'm sorry, the commissioner of health, I assume.
Yes.
Yeah. The commissioner determines that surface water used by a community water system as a drinking water source requires additional protection to limit or eliminate contaminants in the surface water. The commissioner must identify and implement effective water source protection strategies, including on-the-ground practices and regulatory strategies, as necessary to protect public health. So does this give the commissioner of health the authority to implement rules and regulations on farming? If they determine there's pesticides in the water at any level that's a detriment to health, can they start implementing rules around agriculture? In other words, exceeding what they should be limited to protecting health, now they're going to be writing farm regulations.
I don't expect that.
And Representative Wagenius, before you answer, and Representative Munson, I really should have at the beginning said, this bill had a very thorough hearing in HHS policy, and some of the very same questions were asked, and I'm going to allow Representative Wagenius to answer, but, you know, frankly, the bill really doesn't even kind of belong here, and I'm glad to give her a hearing, but it doesn't even impact our budget. So although it has this health Department of Health piece that's been vetted in HHS policy,
okay,
it's sort of here just because it ended up here and we need to move it on. So she can go ahead, but,
okay,
you know, please, it's. I just want to make sure you understand this is not where it's getting its main vetting. Okay, please go ahead, Representative Wagenius.
Thank you for that. I am not changing any of the commissioner's statutory authorities with this bill.
Okay. Madam Chair, I just...
Yeah, Representative Wagenius.
I'm frightened that it got this far without that being changed. That's my concern, so... but I'll leave it to the guys in ag and hope for the best.
All right. Thank you, Representative Munson. Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Wagenius, quick question on the testing of chemicals. Are the neonicotinoids not tested for when they're doing the water tests at this time?
Representative Wagenius.
No, they're not.
They're not.
Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, I'm glad you brought the bill forward. I think the water issues and water testing has been an area that I've had great concern over the last years as I've learned more and more about it. So I appreciate your work on the bill, and I think this is one that we here in Minnesota should be doing significantly more on to determine what's in the water, especially our drinking water. So thanks for bringing this forward.
Representative Haley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Would this be the appropriate time that I can offer my amendment? I have the A1 amendment.
If you wish, I don't know that. So, Representative Wagenius, this is an amendment that has nothing to do with your bill. So,
But it has
ahead.
Everything to do with health of
go ahead,
Minnesota.
Representative Haley.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to offer the A1 amendment, and this is not meant
Madam
to be
Chair.
At all comical.
Chair,
this is very important.
Oh, I'm sorry.
We wait until
Haley?
We get the amendment.
Oh,
we don't
certainly.
Have the amendment.
I'm sorry.
Okay.
It might be in your packet for the previous bill.
The amendment. Okay, so members, the amendment, there is the same amendment as in with all of the bill packets. So it was offered as an amendment to every bill that we have this evening. So. And it's being passed out as well. So we'll just hold on a moment.
Thank you.
It's the same language, I understand. Is that correct?
Yes.
So this is the Representative Haley is offering the A1 amendment to House File 1239.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Haley.
Thank you. It looks like they've been passed out. The A1 amendment covers reinsurance, and my concern is that this afternoon we heard various proposals from commissioners, but we did not get a full discussion on reinsurance, which was compared to the governor's proposal with a premium rebate. This proposal for reinsurance has been proven in Minnesota to lower rates. It's being discussed on the federal stage, actually, by two national Democrats as a proven model that they are talking about on the federal level. I don't think any of these points were illuminated during this afternoon's hearing. As I said, reinsurance is proven to lower rates. What I didn't hear this afternoon and the other proposals from the commissioners was exactly how that proposal would lower rates for Minnesotans. All I saw was increased rates that we then would have to discount in order to have lower rates. Whereas this proposal in the A1 amendment is budget neutral to Minnesota. We have a federal waiver that's good for 5 years, and we have the money already allocated in a fund that we can use to keep rates on the individual market low and to provide the stability that we're all looking for. Again, I appreciate the opportunity to introduce the amendment and to allow some discussion that we didn't get this afternoon on this alternative. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To that comment, reinsurance may not lower rates, but they won't increase as much as they otherwise would without it. So there's a big difference that when you look over the a year period, rates may not be lower, they just won't be as high as they otherwise would with reinsurance. I think that's an important distinction to make, that we don't want to misinform the public about those rates.
Representative Neuer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We've had good testimony from the commissioners today. Giving hundreds of millions of dollars is not a good policy. So with that, we've had 67.5 million dollars that we lost from Minnesota Care. Madam Chair, I oppose this amendment, and I'd like to call for a roll call.
Okay, a roll call has been requested. There will be a roll call. Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I just thought, since I know people have been going in and out, it's deadline week. If you weren't present during the presentation, it was made clear that with the reinsurance proposal, we will lose $96 million in 1 year in Minnesota Care funding from the federal government. So it is not revenue or budget neutral. It is an actual net negative to this committee's budget. The amount will vary by year depending upon a number of factors, but every year that we were shown was in the 90s, 90 plus million, the loss per year in funding that we rely on in this committee for Minnesota Care. So it isn't budget neutral.
Madam Chair.
Representative Haley.
Thank you. To Representative Schultz's point, I would like to say that Commerce has declared many times that reinsurance was indeed responsible for a 20% decrease in rates in 2018 and a 25% decrease in 2019. I would also like to say, for Representative Loeffler's point, the charts that were showed today, and I think I made the comment to the commissioner, and he did agree with me that it was not showing the full story. And in fact, the money that comes into the BHP plan is if our rates are increasing. It's kind of that perverse relationship. So we don't need to kind of rehash that this afternoon, but I just wanted to make the point that I disagree with how those charts were presented.
Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And before the Affordable Care Act, didn't Minnesota have a reinsurance program? Wasn't that MSHA?
Well, Representative Hamilton, to my recollection, and that was not a reinsurance program. MCHA was a program for, you know, since before the Affordable Care Act, insurance companies were free to just decide not to cover people who had pre-existing conditions. And that could have been anything, not only somebody who has your condition, but somebody who, you know, had, I don't know, migraines or, you know, some things that, you know, a lot of people have. So in order to allow there to be some insurance for people who could get no insurance, the state had this program called MCHA. The problem with it, of course, is that, first of all, it required a lot of subsidy. This was not and at times over its history, it required subsidy right out of that the legislature had to subsidize the plan. But not only that, it was at a rate that was higher. It was about, I believe, 125% of the market rate. So for many Minnesotans, it was simply not an answer because they just couldn't afford it. So that's what we had before. To my understanding, that was not reinsurance. It was what was called a high-risk pool that perhaps kept rates lower by keeping, well, the practice that insurance companies always had of guarding their bottom line by trying to make sure that they picked, cherry-picked the enrollees who would be lower cost. That's what kept the rates down. And then if you weren't fortunate enough to be one of those, you were kind of out in the cold.
Well, after After the Affordable Care Act, I know we were looking for a number of legislators, and I know myself, along with Senator Abler, we wrote a letter to the editor, to Star Tribune, talking about the idea of the reinsurance in order to help buy down some of these costs. And we were trying to model it a little bit after Alaska, I believe. They were having some good results with that. And so I guess I've been in the mindset that reinsurance has worked in the past. And so, but I wanted to bring up or get some more clarification on MSHA. So thank you for that.
Well, thank you, Representative Hamilton. And I don't think you were here for the hearing today. Am I right? So you might have missed.
Well,
or
Madam
you were here for some of it.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I actually did have constituents, and then I was in my office, so I turned on and I was listening to it in my office before
I
came back.
Okay. Thank you. And, you know, not in any attempt to, you know, I know members have all kinds of things they have to be doing, and, you know, that's just fine. I just, you know, didn't know if you had access to the entire discussion that we had today, which kind of compared side by side the governor's plan and the reinsurance plan. And with the idea that, you know, and kind of to answer Representative Haley, the really key thing is what does a person have to pay? And can they afford to pay it? If you're in the individual market and you can't afford your premiums and if you can't afford your out-of-pockets, you might as well, you know, not have that opportunity. So, you know, I think to talk about insurance rates is a little bit misleading, because the real issue is what does a person pay? And the fact is, and it was confirmed this afternoon, the reinsurance program, for all its costs, which were not even understood at the beginning when you all passed it, we didn't know that we were going to lose the BHP money, and we did not know the feds were going to not give us as much money under the waiver. But the fact is that it did not affect everyone the same way. So not everyone's premiums went down. And this was, you know, one of the points that I tried to make this afternoon and that they confirmed, is that it depended on, you know, how you were situated, how much or whether your premiums actually did go down under the program. Representative Hamilton.
And thank you, Madam Chair. And believe me, I am searching for answers here, and I'm listening very, very closely, and I'm reading through a number of bills and bill proposals trying to find what I believe is a workable solution as well. Again, I was under the just some background information on the reinsurance pool. I think I may have been the only one from my party when it came up last legislative session to vote against it. It was $542 million, I believe. And I remember that because that's my favorite number, and I'll get into that later. But I voted against it because it didn't have parameters in place. And as far as us getting feedback on that, but I do think we should be having this conversation in addition to some of the others that are going along along with it.
Thank you, Representative Hamilton. Representative Baker.
And again, I want to thank the Representative Haley for just bringing it up, just because I mentioned it today, Madam Chair, was that, again, when you see four commissioners up here, this is a big deal, talking about a very complex issue. But one of the questions I did want to ask further, and maybe we'll follow up with this, is that what will happen with I just lost my train of thought. You ever have that moment? Just blink. It just blinked right out of my head. What's that? Well, the IT cost is a whole other thing I talked about, but, oh, man, Madam Chair, I think what I want to really ultimately get to is so we all get on with our lives tonight. It would be nice. What do you see happening with this conversation going forward? Because, again, I wanted to actually get to the health care plans to come back up here because, on average, they were showing a 20% savings, on average. Some might have been 50% lower, but if there's some that are going over, I want to hear those and see those specific, obviously without names. I want to see what happened if actually some went up with the reinsurance plan. We have to dive into this thing better. Let's find the right way to do this. But because it is a complex issue, and I was not sold on it in the short amount of time we had it today, that the governor's plan going forward is a better idea. I just want to have maybe more ideas from you as to how you want to set some more time aside to talk about this important issue. When will we see that?
Well, Representative Baker, I do not have plans to actually give this bill a hearing. I think it had a hearing in the Senate. It was brought up on the House floor as an amendment. It's being brought up here tonight. We're going to be hearing the governor's budget. We're going to be hearing House File 3 at some point. And so I think that is the discussion that we're going to have. Now, I think that anybody who wants to dive into this further is, of course, you know, the commissioners are available, their staffs are available, and we can get more information. I think we got a lot of information today, maybe too much for one day, you know, and I appreciate that you would like to, you know, we could indeed sit around with them for 5 hours and discuss this. However, that's not what we have in our process. We are a part-time legislature. We are under tight deadlines, and we're going to do our best to meet those deadlines.
And I appreciate that, Madam Chair. We all made a promise to really work hard on this issue and figuring out how to lower these health care costs. We talked about these Band-Aid approaches, but we still got to get to the bottom of this stuff with underlying costs. Again, I'm here for till May 20th like everybody else or so. Let's dive in and do everything we can and work hard on this issue. So, again, with that, I'll support the amendment. So thank you very much.
Representative Schumacher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to thank you for your indulgence on this this evening, and we'll wrap up in just a moment. But this is a good program that we've seen results on. We've seen good results from the program, and the thing that compels me on this is that it's already set up, that we have the infrastructure in place to move forward with it so that people are able to see relief in their insurance rates next year and beyond from this. But at the same time, it's also a point to just bridge so that we can continue to work on other solutions to really lower the healthcare costs. And I think some of what was being discussed or what was being alluded to, that future conversations about the governor's plan will help us with that. But that's really the big point. And we talk about what it's going to take to build this up, and that's not the direction that we want to go. We like that this is already set up, and I would ask for support on the Haley Amendment and congratulate you, Madam Chair, on a strong committee position whenever this vote is taken.
Well, thank you, Representative Schumacher. And I just, just to respond a little bit, you know, I know this has been talked about as a bridge, and it was a bridge for 2 years. And as of right now, it's kind of a bridge to nowhere because we really haven't gotten anything better with the bridge than what we had before, but we spent a whole lot of money. And except, I mean, of course, I acknowledge that people would have, you know, many individuals would have had to pay a lot more out of their pockets. And we know that the people that are in this situation, it really is a terrible situation to be in. So I think we all share the goal of trying to do something to make sure that all Minnesotans can actually access care without going broke. And whether this, though, is the best way to do it, I kind of think that, acknowledging that we need to do a whole lot more than either of the things that were presented today, I think that this is a program that is deeply flawed and that will remain just as flawed and even perhaps more flawed if we allow it to go forward for 3 more years. The point about it already being set up is that just as when it was set up, first of all, it was set up, as I said, at a time when we didn't know what the entire fiscal impact of it was going to be, because the feds kind of took back their promise, or what we thought their promise was, which was to hold us harmless on the basic health plan money. and that they were promising us more money under the waiver. And so it's considerably less of a deal than it even looked like when it was passed. So there's that. But the other thing is that there's really no accountability in this. You know, you can say, well, it worked. It did something for somebody. As I've said, some people actually saw their rates go up. Their out, what they had to pay actually went up. So it didn't do something for everybody. And there's really no, as of this time, as far as I'm aware, there's really no way to be sure that the money that we give the insurance plans really actually translates in any direct way into premium relief for our Minnesotans. So that's an issue that I have with it. Next on the list is Representative Munson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going to pull a Hamilton and separate from my party and say I'm going to vote against this bill because I'm not a supporter of reinsurance or against the amendment. I wasn't surprised. Well, you said you voted against it last year.
I believe it.
Yeah, so I'm not surprised that insurance premiums went down when we dumped hundreds of millions of dollars into it. That's usually the expectation. If I say I'm going to buy half your dinner, don't be surprised when it's half the cost. But I would much rather involve the patient directly versus the insurance companies, because then we have usually less fraud. But I would much rather, again, like I said earlier in the meeting, go after some free market approaches and price transparency and get into the details and empower patients over empowering the insurance industry or just subsidizing everything. So I just wanted to add that. And because I mentioned Representative Hamilton's name, he gets a defense.
Okay, well, I have Representative Baker on the list first, and then I'll go to Hamilton.
And I wasn't going to speak to this, Madam Chair, again, but I guess I felt like I needed to stand up for the insurance companies that that did what they said they were supposed to do the last couple of years, and I think that was supported by Commissioner Kelly today. I think he actually said they did what they were supposed to do. They delivered this, and I thought he felt that it was a legitimate program, so I just didn't want to have that be ignored tonight because I don't know that I would have agreed with that statement, so I just want to put on the record that I think that they deserve a little bit more credit for what they actually did do for the last couple of years. So with that, I just wanted to make sure that was on the record.
Okay, and just to be clear, Representative Baker, I'm not saying they didn't. I'm just saying the program itself had no accountability built into it that would ensure that. So it's, I'm really criticizing the program, yeah. Not the company.
And you're right. You're right. And they proved that they knew that those guardrails were really not in place, and they wanted to make sure they delivered, I think, a fair product at the end. And to their credit, let's give – once in a while when they do something good, let's give them a thumbs up too, okay?
Representative Hamilton.
And thank you, Madam Chair. I think I'm going to pull a Munson and vote for it. No, I'm just kidding about pulling the old Munson. But I am. I believe I'm going to support it tonight so we can continue having this discussion. So thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Seeing no Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And for those of you who want to continue the discussion in the future, I would value the information that we didn't get, which is what was the impact on patient care, which I think should be our number one priority. And when we picked up 80% of the cost of anyone whose health charges went over $50,000 up to $250,000, I still would like to know, how did that influence patient care? And when you hit $250,000 and $10, and your doctor suggested additional tests, additional treatment, additional chemotherapy, whatever, what was the response from the health plan for those over $250,000? Because if we're going to seriously evaluate this and consider it as an alternative, then I just really want to know what happened to the patients as a result of changing the financial incentives.
Yeah, and let me just thank you, Representative Loeffler, and I'm going to give Representative Haley the last word on the amendment, but I just do want to say, too, that for those of you like Representative Munson who you want to continue to work on this, whatever we're going to do this session is not going to be the be-all and end-all. That we all know. And so I think that we're going to, I for one, have the intention to continue working on this over the interim. I'm not sure what form that's going to take yet, Representative Schumacher, but you know, I'm certainly open to that when we have more time. Oftentimes we do our best solving problems when we do it outside the legislative session just because we're under such pressure here and all of us have so many things on our plates, but we definitely will need to continue to work on these issues, and I am very happy to work with any of you that are interested in doing so. So with that, Representative Haley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just two final points. In my amendment, Section 1 really is all about accountability, so I appreciate your comments that that's an important aspect. And also, no money has been spent on reinsurance. That's really a false statement that keeps getting repeated. We are waiting for the final numbers from the plans, and the incoming money that the federal government gives us to this program is estimated to cover 2017-2018 costs. So there has not been a check written to an insurance company yet to cover reinsurance. I want to be very clear on that. I appreciate your indulgence. This is important to each and every one of us because it's important to each and every Minnesotan, and we are all trying to get it right. We are all trying to improve the cost of care and the cost of insurance and make sure that our constituents have quality care close to home that they can access and that they can afford. And I believe because of that value that we all share here tonight, it's important that we can openly vet all the options before us, and that's why I brought the amendment tonight, because we did not get that opportunity this afternoon. Thank you very much. I'd appreciate your support on the amendment.
All right. The clerk will take the roll.
Liebling.
No.
Akam.
No.
Baker.
Yes.
Bierman.
No.
Cantrell.
No.
Franson. Grunhagen. Haley.
Yes.
Halverson. Hamilton.
Yes.
Kunish-Podein.
No.
Loeffler.
No.
Mann. Moran.
No.
Munson.
No.
Noor.
No.
Olson.
No.
Schumacher.
Aye.
Schultz.
No.
Zerwas.
There being four ayes and 11 nays, the motion does not prevail. The amendment is not adopted. So we are back on the bill. And was there any further discussion to House File 1239? All right, seeing none. I will renew my motion that House File 1239 be recommended to be re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. The motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Wagenius. You got to sit here and observe our conversation. We're going to take Representative Moran's bill next, House File 2415. Representative Moran will move that House File 1215 be laid over for possible inclusion in the HHS Division Omnibus Bill. I'm sorry, 2415. Sorry, read the wrong number. And we have, and there's an author's amendment, I understand. Representative Moran, did you want to offer the A2 amendment? The A2 amendment? To put the bill in the order in which you'd like to discuss it?
Yes. And Madam Chair, we've been in conversation with DHS and the community in regards to this bill, and they have come up with some other compromises, so I'm hoping that we can make an oral amendment also to the bill.
Certainly. Representative Moran, did you want to move the A2, though, and have that adopted first, or was the amendment to the A2 amendment?
I believe we can move the A2. There's someone coming down.
Okay.
Madam Chair, I think I'm going to let the testifier explain the oral amendment and the A2 amendment.
Okay. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Please state your name and your affiliation.
My name is Jeff Schiff. I'm the medical director at the Department of Human Services.
Okay. Could you please spell your last name? I'm sorry.
Sure. recovered from a cold. Schiff, S-C-H-I-F-F.
Thank you. Please go ahead.
Madam Chair, I think this, our discussion, I think, replaces the A2 amendment. We are, in conjunction with the author, are suggesting the, just want to make sure I get the right, the striking of sections 1 and 2, which are around CHW licensing and reimbursement for doula services.
Okay, so Mr. Schiff, are we on the bill then? On the,
yes.
On the body of the bill?
Yes.
And so please tell us again now that we're looking at the... At
so if it's, we're looking to strike sections 1, line 1.10 through section 2, line 2.16.
Okay, so Representative Moran, is that your, would that be your oral amendment? I think it would be essentially striking sections 1 and section 2 of the bill.
Yes, Madam Chair.
And then we have one.
Okay,
and we have one other oral amendment.
And one other one. Well, maybe we could take that one. Is the other one, well, go ahead, Mr. Schiff, tell us what the other one is.
The other one is on line 5.1 through 5.2. We would like to reinstate that part because that compels the department to work with the this group to find continuing program funding, but remove the due date. So we would reinstate, include recommendations for continuing the program or sustaining improvements through other means, period.
Okay, is that it then?
Yes, thank you.
Okay, so can maybe House Research could just restate it just to make sure we have it all correctly? I think we could do, could we do both at once? Sure, okay.
So, Madam Chair and members, the amendments would be page 1, delete section 1, page 2, delete section 2. Then page, and I can provide this to committee staff as well. Page 4, line 28, delete and, the underlined and. Page 4, line 30, reinstate the stricken and. Then on page 5, lines 1 and 2, you would reinstate both lines 1 and 2, and then on line 2, strike beyond June 30th, 2010.
2019.
I'm sorry, 2019.
Yeah. Time has moved on. Did everybody get the oral amendment? Because it is kind of a lot. Okay. It looks like it. And so, Representative Moran, is that your amendment then?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Okay. So, Representative Moran is making that motion. I don't think I need to reinstate it, but what Mr. Chun just went through. All those in favor of the oral amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted.
Thank you.
Okay. And then, Representative Moran, I take it the other amendments are, you have the A2 we no longer need. Is that right?
Absolutely, Madam Chair.
Okay, and then there's also in the packet is the A3, which I take it we don't need that one either. Okay.
No.
Very good. Please go ahead and present your bill as amended.
Okay, Madam Chair, this is a bill relating to human services that's called
for. Representative Moran, I'm so sorry, but could you move the mic a bit because I'm having trouble hearing you.
So this is a bill relating to human services that calls for modifying medical assistance coverage for a community health worker, establishing a permanent grant program for integrated care, also called coordinated or comprehensive care, for high-risk pregnancy. The work is aimed at native-born African-American women who are 3 to 4 times as likely to die from pregnancy-related causes as their white counterpart. This bill is also calling for appropriating money and amending statutes, Minnesota Statute 2018, Section 256B, 0625, and some other statutes. The Integrated Care for High-Risk Pregnancy Pilot Project was funded by the Department of Human Services, DHS, grants made possible by Minnesota Statute 256B.79. In the spirit of Governor Walz's pledge to empower indigenous and communities of color with tools needed to succeed, the African-American community would like for the funding for this work to be driven by the African-American community and that funds specifically support the work of the existing pilot, which has demonstrated success. As an African-American mother, I am well aware of the challenges that mothers face during pregnancy and the risks that impact African-American women across economic lines. Infant borns to college-educated black parents were twice as likely to die as infants born to similar educated white parents. These birth outcomes are prevalent across the country, and Minnesota has one of the highest of disparities when African-American and American Indian birth outcomes are compared to whites. I believe these issues are worthy of continuous support and that the pilot work will ultimately help decrease the birth disparities in Minnesota African-American community. For that reason, I agree to author this bill. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you, Representative Moran. And you have some testifiers?
Yes.
And
my name is Nora Hall, PhD. I'm working as a consultant with the Integrated Care for High-Risk African-American Women pilot. And I'd like to thank you all for this opportunity to share what we consider real life and death issues that we're dealing with when we think about high-risk pregnancies in African-American communities. I want to share just a bit of background about the, we also call this ITERP, so I'll be referring to that, about ITERP, the pilot. I want to you all to know that the program has had a lot of positive outcomes over the last year or so that it's been in existence. They've seen more than 30,000 African-American families and health professionals through conferences and in-person clinic visits, as well as through media organizations. And there are four organizations working with Integrated Care for High-Risk African-American Women. They are Minnesota Community Care, which used to be Westside Community Health, North Point Health and Wellness Incorporated, Open Cities Health Center, and African-American Babies Coalition and Projects. They are working in Hennepin and Ramsey County to look at the disparities among African Americans in prenatal and infant mortality and low and very low birth weights. And these are the areas where these are significantly elevated. The components of the pilot are, one, being driven by the African American community, which is very important, being culturally specific. And the third one is having these integrated care teams. The ITERP model relies very much on social determinants of health, which is very much linked to cultural factors, cultural knowledge, and cultural information. And the team relies quite a lot on paraprofessionals. So when we think about integrated teams, it is a team of many, many paraprofessionals as well, and in addition to doctors, nurses, and others. For example, we have community outreach workers. We have behavioral health practitioners who are people helping to diagnose things like mental health, care navigators who help people understand the systems they're a part of, as well as peer support specialists, people who understand what the recovery process might be for a particular person. So these paraprofessionals are not compensated under medical assistance, so one of the things that we're looking for is for some support for them. So in closing, I just want to make a couple comments. One is, we're making a request that the funding associated with integrated care for high-risk African-American pregnancies be community-driven and that it supports ongoing work of the pilot as opposed to grants that are given to others who may be working in this area. The next thing is that that the work that we're doing does not have a sunset date, which we just did in the oral amendment. And then the third thing is that there is Medicaid funding to support the paraprofessionals who work on these projects. My colleague is going to provide some example of maybe a couple of stories of things that have happened in this process.
All right. Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. Welcome to the committee. Please give us your name and if you're affiliated with someone, and then go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the House. Maybe I've said that wrong, but my name is Teresa McClinty. I go by T. McClinty, and I work at North Point Health and Wellness Center located in North Minneapolis. And I am the project manager for our Integrative Care for High-Risk Pregnancy Initiative. And so just some background, North Point is one of the grantees. As my colleague said, we work in partnership with our partners, Westside. And so we do a lot of referrals back and forth. But our program in North Minneapolis, as many of you know, is in a hub of North Minneapolis. And so we work in a very diverse community, but we were very excited to be part of this initiative because it works with African-American women. I know about high-risk pregnancies. I have three black sons and two C-sections. So when this came along, I said this is very fitting and very appropriate. So we have three community health workers at North Point who work on this initiative. Our community health workers go out and they do home visits with our clients. They do a lot of referrals. So one of the things that we did, our grant talks about partnering or strengthening partnerships. And so one of our big partners is North Memorial Hospital. I went there and had a meeting with their OB unit on the night shift and day shift. They were doing a shift change. My background, I have 19 years in emergency medicine. And so it was a pleasure to get back in the health field. And I got to meet with the night shift and the day shift OB staff. And we talked about how we wanted to partner. We're not the professionals. None of us are our providers. But they also recognize some of the gaps that they have working with some of their African-American women. And we felt that we could help bridge those gaps with the providers and with the OB staff. And so in doing that, they sent us referrals for their women who may not be attending appointments and for various reasons. And so when we get the referral, we do what's called pre-risk assessment overview, and it gives us a mental health screening number. And so if a woman comes in, referred to us, and we do a previous assessment, the assessment, anything can be high between a 7 or above. I can tell you that we have a lot of clients that sit in the 20s, that sit in the 15s, and that means they need immediate intervention or they need some more support. So sometimes we'll call the provider back and say, this referral that you gave us, your woman is having some high triggers. We identify what those high triggers are after we do the assessment. And we talk about what their triggers are. It's called social determinants of health. And so we talk about what is your high trigger. Sometimes that trauma could be their neighborhood. And sometimes talking to, respectfully, I have a lot of white allies, but I'll say they don't quite always understand that my trauma may be my neighborhood. As a black person, I'm a mom. I'm trying to raise this child who now I'm pregnant with a son, and there's a lot of shooting in my neighborhood. I don't have means of transportation. I don't have means to get to a doctor appointment. And so we try to work with them. We don't want to make them dependent on us, but we try to provide resources for independence. So why is it important for you to go to your doctor appointment? What is your trauma? And so one of our community health workers said, share my story. So she had an internal referral. North Memorial, as you know, on the human service side, we have a food shelf. We have lots of internal programs that we do in human service. So that referral came to us because a mom came in for some food. And our navigators are trained to do assessment questions. Based on those assessment questions, they refer the woman to us. And so we screened her, and she had high-risk triggers. And so we found out what those were, and we referred her to a mental health provider. We referred her to some housing support. She was living in a shelter. And she wound up delivering her child. Our community health worker said that she went up there to see her because our community health worker followed her to make sure that she was going to her doctor appointments, why it was important for her to go to her doctor appointments. Did you follow up on that referral that we provided for you for housing? Did you follow up on referral for SNAP for insurance benefits? And so just by having that support of the community health worker who was by her side, she was able to follow her through her delivery day, so she delivered, and then she attended her, went to visit her in the hospital and brought her a gift bag because she didn't have Pampers for the child, and brought her a gift bag and just said, we'll still follow you. We'll still make sure that you are being taken care of. And she cried, and she said, I never got this much help. And I don't think we were able to do that without this initiative, without the support of this integrative high care risk model that we have through DHS. And so that's just one of the stories that we could share with many. We have 117 active clients right now at North Point that we are seeing, and those are coming from. We have 43 external partners that we work with outside of North Point. So 43 community partners in North Minneapolis and Brooklyn Park, Brooklyn Center. And that took us going out in the community, talking about this initiative, and there is a need. There are providers who say, yes, we want to partner with you. So we have 43 providers who said we will partner with you. And so that's how we are getting our referrals in externally and internally when people walk into North Point for Food Shelf. And that's how we're getting those. So those are just some of those stories, Madam Chair.
Okay. Well, thank you. Were you finished? I'm sorry. We have another testifier, too? I didn't want to cut you off. Were you finished?
Okay. No, this is it, Madam Chair.
Okay. All right. Very good. Are there questions from the committee? All right. Not seeing any. I would like to ask Mr. Berg to explain with the amendments to the bill. I think it impacts the fiscal note. And so I wanted to see if Mr. Berg would tell us what that impact is.
Madam Chair, members, the amendment that took place at the beginning with the deletion of Section 2, all the costs that are listed on the front page, which were relative to Section 2, which was the doula rate. We've had that in other bills, and the costs look the same here. After that, the only thing that's relevant in the fiscal note is I think there was some discussion of funding for the grants for the high-risk pregnancy. On page 3, you'll see a paragraph that says Sections 5 through 9 of the bill extend authorization for grants to support community-based organizations, et cetera, et cetera. The relevant line at the end being these costs are already incorporated into the base budget, therefore no additional appropriation is needed to maintain the current capacity of the program. So, and I confirmed with DHS that at the current capacity, they assume the bill at this point has no cost.
Well, that's usually pretty good news, Representative Moran. Your bill is free now. Okay, well, that's great. Any questions to that, members? All right, seeing none. So Representative Moran is going to renew her motion that House File, 2415, as amended, be laid over for possible inclusion in the HHS Division Finance or Omnibus Bill. So it is laid over. Thank you very much, testifiers. Thank you, Representative Moran.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. We are going to move along and pick up the last bill, which is Representative Lean. And House File 840, and the chair is going to move that House File 840 be laid over for possible inclusion in the HHS Division Omnibus Bill. Welcome to the committee, Representative Lean.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. I appreciate hearing this bill tonight. House File 840 would add scaling and root planing back to the list of covered dental services for medical assistance. There are two common dental diseases, and only tooth decay is currently covered by MA. Periodontal disease, more commonly known as gum disease, used to be covered but has not been for 10 years. A little bit of history on this issue. In 2009, when the state was suffering from a budget deficit in the billions, benefits for adults on medical assistance were cut in half, and unfortunately this included the treatment of gum disease. Periodontal disease is a serious condition that increases costs as it gets worse. Sometimes gum disease needs to be treated first before a patient can undergo any other care, including operations. If gum disease is left untreated, it can lead to requiring treatment for other health problems, as well as hospitalizations. In general, it costs more to leave gum disease untreated than it would be to treat it. And we have numerous studies from health insurance companies showing treatment of gum disease actually reduces overall medical costs for patients with a number of chronic health care issues such as heart disease, diabetes, dementia, and others. Because we are not covering the treatment of gum disease, dental and medical costs increase, and Minnesotans are not getting the care they need. With me tonight, I have Dr. Mary Syro, Chief of Dentistry at Hennepin County Medical Center, which is a large provider of dental services for a very complex Medicaid population, to address the bill and answer any questions you might have. Also in your packets, Madam Chair and members, are letters of support from the Minnesota Dental Hygienists Association, the Minnesota Board of Dentistry, and the Minnesota Dental Association. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Lean. And I have to say I did read the letter before that came from the Board of Dentistry, and I recommend members to read this. So, Dr. Syro, welcome to the committee. Please give us your name for the record.
Mary Syro,
And I want to start by thanking you, Madam Chair, for making oral health a priority over the years and your years of work in advocacy for oral health in general. You've been very dedicated to this issue, and I want to thank you for that. As Representative Lean said, I'm the Chief of Dentistry at Hennepin Healthcare, and I suspect that you're all familiar with Hennepin Healthcare and our mission. I don't know if you know much about our dental department. We have a multi-specialty dental practice, and we provide both comprehensive care and emergency dental care for some of the most vulnerable and medically complex patients in the state. For many of the patients that come to see us, we truly are their last hope for getting the care that they need. So today, though, I'm here speaking on behalf of Dental Access Partners, which includes Hennepin Healthcare, Appletree Dental, and Community Dental Care. And together, these three critical access organizations serve patients from 85 of the 87 Minnesota counties and that also reach people facing barriers to care. We deliver dental services at clinics and at over 175 sites, including Head Start centers, schools, nursing homes, and other locations. So, given the broad bipartisan support for this bill and the growing understanding of why restoring periodontal services is so important, I'm going to make just three key points. First, there are two main diseases of the mouth, tooth decay and periodontal disease. Medical assistance currently covers treatment of only one of those diseases, and that is the treatment of tooth decay. Periodontal disease is an infection of the gums and the bone around the teeth, and treatment for this condition is not covered. This bill simply corrects that problem and adds by adding in a very basic benefit that is the simplest and most cost-effective treatment for periodontal disease. The second point I want to emphasize is that untreated infections of the mouth not only destroy the teeth and jawbone, but have wide-ranging negative impacts on overall health, the ability to eat, to perform in school, to get a job, and on a patient's overall self-esteem. So failing to treat infection early leads inevitably to more dental disease and a decline in overall health. The final point I want to make is the economic point. As you've heard from Representative Lean, numerous economic analysis show that patients with common chronic conditions who receive periodontal treatment have significantly lower overall medical costs. For heart disease, the savings in one study was $1,000 per patient per year. For cardiovascular disease and stroke, $5,000 per patient per year. For diabetes, $2,800 per patient per year. According to the American Diabetes Association, approximately 467,000 people in Minnesota have either diabetes or prediabetes. That's about 10.5% of our adult population, and the cost of providing care to those patients and treating their diabetes is $4.4 billion each year. Adding this benefit has a significant potential to for cost savings within the medical system. In closing, I encourage you to support this bill. There's broad consensus with strong support from the Dental Association, the Dental Hygiene Association, the Board of Dentistry, and in many individual clinicians across the state. So it will improve health, reduce disparities, and help drive down overall health care costs. Thank you again for the opportunity to testify, and I welcome your questions.
All right. Thank you very much, Dr. Syro. Are the questions, Representative Zerwas?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and Jarvis Evelyn, I love this bill, so thank you for coming forward with it. And I think, Madam Chair, one of the challenges, as the testifier was just talking about, one of the challenges with our fiscal note process is, unlike in the federal system, we operate with a static fiscal note process and not a dynamic scoring of the impact of a policy change like this. And when we talk about increase in costs in other health areas because of untreated periodontal or gum disease, in the study that the test bar was referring to, I've seen some of that information that talks about patients that would otherwise benefit from this scaling procedure and the treatment of the advanced periodontal disease who have underlying factors, heart disease, diabetes, other issues. That's leading to a compounding of cost within the MA program. And so it's, I mean, the fiscal note says in the first biennium it's $2.3 million, in the second biennium it's $6.3 million. And the challenge is that's just taking into account the now covering this treatment and not the cost avoidance that you have in preventative care and actually taking care of people up front that will later, as the study shows, present at the hospital with other symptoms related to advanced gum disease. And so it's a tough job as we put the bill together. And one of the limitations in how we do this is not being able to look at some of those factors. I guess as my as a minority member, one of my requests as you put your bill together, Madam Chair, is that that we're able to prioritize these bills that kind of go upstream and preventative when we look at programs like this, because I think this is how we start to bend the cost curve and start to make an impact.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Zerwas. And the testifier thanked me for my work in dental, but I want to acknowledge that I am certainly not the only advocate for this around this table and in this body, and including in the Senate. We have some members who are very, very interested in these issues, and thank you very much for that, Representative Zerwas. I appreciate that. And are there other questions for the testifier or... Okay, I do have one before we go to Representative Lean to close up. But Dr. Syro, what's really kind of stunning to me about this is that the 10 years that we haven't been paying for this, and, you know, so what have you been doing in the meantime? I mean, what is happening to these patients? Are they just getting uncompensated care? Because it's hard to imagine caring practitioners leaving patients with terrible disease and not treating it. But, I mean, I don't want to put you on the spot, but, you know, I mean, it's really horrible to think that this has been the case. Can you address that?
Yes, Madam Chair. So for the most part, dentists will do the procedures that have to be done, especially within the safety net community, in order to stabilize it. The patient situation, because it would, in our mind, be unethical to treat decay on a tooth that has periodontal disease as well. So we want the whole mouth to be healthy. So yes, there is a lot of uncompensated care that's being done around this.
Okay, thank you. Other questions for members or comments? All right, seeing none, Representative Lean, would you like to close?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Committee members, I really appreciate hearing this bill tonight. I know you've had a busy day, so like you said, I appreciate that. And Representative Zerwas, thank you for your comments. I know you've certainly been a champion of dental care and helping people to get access to dental care in your time in the legislature and the dozens of bills you've introduced on this issue. So thank you for that. And Madam Chair, too, thank you for your commitment to helping out lower-income Minnesotans get the access to care. I did just want to say, I just saw the fiscal note today. I myself did get a little sticker shock on that. I didn't assume the cost would be that high on it. But we are working with the department on its stakeholders. And the way the bill is written, the way it's structured, we do have some parameters to work around how we can get this care to people, different timelines, different amounts of care that could be allowed under this bill. So there are ways we can work around this and try to bring the cost down a little bit.
Right, so. Representative Lean, so you're telling me the bill might be scalable?
We can plan on scaling it, yes.
Okay, yes. Well, great. Well, so thank Representative you. Lean renews, or I will renew my motion that House File 840 be laid over for possible inclusion in the HHS Division Omnibus Bill. Thank you very much, Representative Lean. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Committee members.
All right, so that concludes our agenda for today. Thank you very much, members. We are adjourned.